It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
What is with this company's obsession with ninjas?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
Too many ninjas.
You haven't been beat up properly.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
For those of you who are still hanging in there, suffering through 3 hours of Monday Night Raw each week, just like me, WWE has created quite the business strategy. They put together an awful show like the one they gave us last Monday, and then when you're at your most vulnerable, right? You're just at your lowest point. They'll ply you with wine to help get you through next week's show. WWE introduced its new line of wines this week. WWE Wines. Now available for pre-order. And of all the people to market this around, the two names they chose, it's hilarious because I've talked about this before. Whether it's the ice cream bars, whether it's some of the video games and the promotion for the video games, they rely so heavily on the legends over their current roster of talent. And this is just another example of this. But of all the names they could have chosen for this, the two that they are building this venture around, at least to start with, noted wine connoisseur The Undertaker and The Ultimate Warrior, whose wine features a rich and dark 80% Zinfandel, a 20% Sangiovese blend from the north coast of California. They start shipping out October 22nd, just in time for the holiday season. So instead of getting your loved one, I guess, yet another fruitcake this Christmas, you can get them a tombstone-shaped glow-in-the-dark bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon, courtesy of The Undertaker. I want to hear The Undertaker say that out loud, by the way. Cabernet Sauvignon. No bottle of wine would be enough to get me through whatever the hell that garbage was that I watched on Monday night. With the single worst faction reveal of any faction I've ever seen. And I've seen some awful factions. In all the years I've been watching wrestling, all different promotions, I've seen some bad ones. I've seen the Truth Commission. I've seen the League of Nations. I've seen the Cosmic Wasteland. Remember them? Stardust and the Ascension. Even the Aces, and I can't even believe I'm saying this, but even the Aces and Eights, I would take the Aces and Eights over this shit. At least they had cool music. And they had this great reveal when Bully Ray finally went heel. After that, it was all downhill. This is episode 671 of the Solo Monster Sounds Of here for Clash of Champions Sunday, September 27th, 2020. I am the Solo Monster. Do support our wonderful sponsor, Audible. Go to audibletrial.com/solomonster if you want to get yourself a free book. If you're bored, you're still working from home, stuck at home, you have nothing better to do. Or if you're an avid reader, maybe you've not tried audiobooks before, you don't know if you'll like them or not, you can get one free book if you use our link and sign up for the 30-day trial. So audibletrial.com/solomonster. And I want to give a shout out to all of our PayPal VIPs this week who make it all worthwhile when they show their support. If you want to support, entirely up to you. TheSolomonster.com is the place to go. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. There's no subscription. There's nothing that renews. It's entirely up to you, but that is the place to go. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. And I want to say thank you to DeVenom John Eru, showing some big-time support this week, and I do appreciate it. John Loose Cannon Lopez, good to have Loose Cannon back. Deadpool James Herrera. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton. The Florida Freebird Brian Becerra. Beast Mode Brock Joseph. Killshot Keith Hart. The Moldovan Masochist Alexandru Mata. Rolex Robin Party. Dastardly Derek Smith. Raymond the Mountie Medina. Stephen Handyman Hallowstick. The Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. Josh the Shooter Stockton. Ostentatious Alan Carter. Jake the Snake Harrison. John Raging Mad Riffle, Night Stalker Naif Al-Safar, the Carolina Panther Bradley Gooch, New York Punk Arnold Modesto, Stormy Skies Ryan Spies, the Rabbit King Christian Dye, the Firebomber Craig Foster, the Helsinki Hitman Valtteri Haivarinen, and a very special shout out here to Mike Madman Banks. He has been a listener of the show since 2012, and I am told he is currently on a birthday holiday in Ireland because he turns the big 4-0 today. And your family, including Mr. Money in the Banks, wanted to wish you a very happy birthday. I will join with them and do the same. So happy birthday, my friend. I hope you're having a good time. Radiant Ray Wrighton, she's celebrating her birthday on Tuesday. And RJ, I know you're listening. I hope you have a fantastic day. And last but not least, I want to just give a quick shout out to Dean the Mighty Mo Mowbray. You have heard me talk about Dean before in his Scenescape shop on Etsy. He's got all of his wrestling and non-wrestling paintings, something that he took up in the past year or so. He's not a professional painter, but as you have seen his work, he is getting better and better each time. He's got some really cool paintings up there, and I wanted to relay a message from him to all of you. It really meant a lot to him, all the people who went and checked out his store, and as a show of thanks, he is offering everyone who listens to the Sound Off, exclusive to Sound Off listeners, 20% off all of his prints, wrestling and non-wrestling, on Etsy through the end of the year. In fact, he has a new one up of the Legion of Doom, which I think he may have done it before Animal passed away this past week, so it's kind of timely. But just use the code SOLOMONSTER at checkout to activate the 20% discount at etsy.com/shop/scenescape shop. That is the full address. And I also know it would mean a lot to him if you went and subbed to his YouTube channel as well. Just type in Scenescape Shop, all one word, on YouTube, and it should come right up. And Dean, congrats on all of your success. Now, I mentioned the Legion of Doom. Road Warrior Animal died on Tuesday, not even 2 weeks after his 60th birthday and the day after his wedding anniversary. Said to have been of natural causes, that's all we know so far. I said this on Wednesday because I did talk a little bit about this on the Dynamite stream. He joins a growing list of names, does Animal, in the wrestling business that have been lost in 2020. And some big names, too. You know, names like Howard Finkel, Kamala, Rocky Johnson, Bullet Bob Armstrong, Shad Gaspard, Hana Kimura, Xavier, Danny Havoc. I mean, there's been a whole bunch of names. And some of them were older, but some of them were not very old at all. And in May, I spent over half an hour here on the podcast talking about Hawk and Animal when I reviewed their Dark Side of the Ring episode. The Road Warriors were an iconic team. They were popular everywhere they went, the only team ever to hold AWA, NWA, and WWE gold. Ole Anderson was the one who discovered both of them. They were bar bouncing in Minnesota at the time. Animal started out as a singles wrestler called the Road Warrior. And he had gotten his girlfriend pregnant and realized that he wasn't making as much money wrestling as he was bouncing. So he decided, the hell with this, I'm going to go back to doing that. And Ole had no idea that Hawk also worked doing that kind of stuff. He had no idea Hawk even existed. He had gone back, I guess, to the same bar. And when he found out that there were two of them, he said, man, I got to convince this guy to come back and I got to put these two guys together as a tag team. And that's how the Road Warriors were born. And the name, the mohawk, the look, the shoulder pads, it was all lifted from that Mad Max movie from the 80s. They worked with Dusty, they worked with Nikita, the Horsemen. I mean, they were part of that glory period for Jim Crockett Promotions. And then they went to WWE in 1990. And they won the tag team titles there. But they had a lot of problems, or at least Hawk did. Hawk had some issues. Well-documented issues. And so their run came to an end. They had a falling out. The two of them had a falling out. They did reunite in 1996. in WCW. They had a couple more runs in WWE during the Attitude Era. And that was pretty much the end of their run. They had a tryout match in 2003. A quick cameo appearance on Monday Night Raw that did not go well. That was against Kane and Rob Van Dam. Hawk passed away that same year. And Animal actually got another short run in WWE doing the Legion of Doom gimmick with Heidenreich. They won the tag team titles very briefly. And that was pretty much it. You know, Animal was a staple at a lot of the wrestling conventions all over the country. He was upset. He had talked in interviews about being upset that WWE did not give him a look for a job as a trainer at the PC. He felt he had a lot to contribute, and for whatever reason, I don't know if he felt he was being blackballed or just given the cold shoulder for some reason. You know, his brother works there, has worked there ever since WCW folded, John Laurinaitis. So I know that bothered him. But look, you know, both Road Warriors may be gone now, but they're going to go down as probably the greatest tag team of all time, in my opinion. They had it all. They had it all. They had the look. They had the music. They were booked like monsters who rarely, if ever, lost, especially when they first debuted. Right place, right time. You know, those two guys come along today. They're probably the authors of pain. They don't last very long. Right place, right time. And they were over like crazy. They drew a lot of money. You know, when I think of tag teams, when I think of tag team wrestling, I think there's a few teams that come to mind immediately. I think of the Hart Foundation. I think of the British Bulldogs. I think of Demolition. Arn and Tully. I think of the Steiners. A lot of people would say the Freebirds. You know, I didn't grow up with them, but yes, a lot of people would say the Freebirds, maybe even the Von Erichs. Midnight Express, Rock and Roll Express. There have been a lot of great tag teams. The Road Warriors are the first team that I picture in my head when I think of tag team wrestling. There was never a more dominant team, probably never will be ever again. Tonight is WWE Clash of Champions Gold Rush. I spent over 90 minutes on YouTube running down the card with my predictions and your predictions on Thursday. I'll give you the Cliff Notes version here, kind of, with some more thoughts thrown in now that I've had a chance to watch SmackDown, which I thought was a very good show this week. Thought SmackDown blew Raw out of the water, which I know is setting the bar very low, but I thought SmackDown was a good show this week. First, though, I will be live on YouTube tonight, immediately after Clash of Champions, so watch for the event page. I usually get it up maybe about half an hour after the pay-per-view starts. That way people can start filing in, you can chat in there, hit that like button, all that good stuff. So watch for that. I'll link everybody to it on Twitter and Facebook. I'm also hosting. I have the great privilege yet again of hosting the Wrestle Rumble raffle, the big one this month, and it's the biggest one they've ever done. This is the NXT Gold Rush raffle for WrestleRumble.com tonight. You still have time to enter right up until 7 p.m. Eastern tonight when the pay-per-view goes on the air. It's only a dollar. You can enter as many times as you like for the chance to win 8 NXT championship belts. 8. Got the NXT title, the NXT women's title, the NXT North American title, NXT tag team titles, both of them, the NXT Cruiserweight Championship, the NXT UK Championship, and the NXT UK Women's Championship. And I'm going to tell you right now, this could be the final time that Wrestle Rumble does a giveaway where one person wins that many belts. So you want to make sure you get in on this. Go to WrestleRumble.com to enter. I'm going to be picking the winner at random live during my stream on the air tonight. The belts ship out the very next day to the winner via FedEx. Imagine getting that delivery. You got 8 belts being shipped to your door. That's quite the drop-off. So go to WrestleRumble and get in on the fun. You're not going to want to miss this one. I'm looking forward tonight. What am I looking most forward to? I am looking forward most to the Universal Championship match between Roman Reigns and Jey Uso. And I am looking forward to the ladder match for the Intercontinental title, AJ Styles, Jeff Hardy, and Sami Zayn. Both of which happen to be SmackDown matches, the Raw half of this card tonight. Not so much. Not so much am I interested in that. Zelina Vega, she beat Mickie James on Raw Monday night. Her first win all year, to earn the right to challenge for the Raw Women's Championship against Asuka. And this is on the kickoff show. Some people are kicking up a fuss about that, but this match is exactly where it belongs. This match had no build. Zelina Vega came out of nowhere. She's not typically a wrestler. I guess now she's going to branch off into the singles division. And the match just sort of came out of nowhere, and it feels like something for Asuka to do to get her to Hell in a Cell, to get her to Survivor Series. So this match being on the kickoff show, to be honest, I mean, yeah, Asuka was wrestling multiple matches on some of the recent pay-per-views, but this is not a match that needs to be on the main card. It was just thrown together at the last minute, so you know what? It's exactly where it belongs. And Asuka ain't losing the Raw Women's Championship on the kickoff show. So I got Asuka to retain. Monday night, WWE booked a triple threat match to determine who challenges the Street Profits for the Raw Tag Team titles tonight. It was Seth Rollins and Murphy, Dominic Mysterio and Humberto Carrillo, and Andrade and Angel Garza. Surprise, surprise. Andrade and Garza, who now seem to be back on the same page together, no Zelina Vega in their corner. They picked up the win, which means that we are yet again getting another match between Andrade, Angel Garza, and the Street Profits for the Raw Tag Team titles. This time, I'm going to go with Andrade and Garza, just for the sake of being different, right? The outcome has been the same every single time these teams get in the ring together. How many freaking times are we going to see this match? And it just feels to me like, you know what? They got to do something different here. So we might see a title change tonight. So I'm going to go with Andrade and Garza to win the championships. Not that any of this even matters. Because you know exactly if they win the belts, you know exactly where they go from here. It's another match. It's another match with the Street Profits. So what does it really even matter? Cesaro and Shinsuke Nakamura. They defend their SmackDown Tag Team titles against the Lucha House Party. Lucha House Party has had their issues of late. Kalisto seems like he's on his way out. He's fed up with his partners. Cesaro and Shinsuke are my pick to retain. The future does not look good. It does not look bright for the SmackDown Tag Team Division or the Raw Tag Team Division. They missed their chance on this pay-per-view. Clash of Champions could have been a unification opportunity. The next shot they got is Survivor Series. Raw versus SmackDown, typically. They could do it there. They got to do something. Unless they have five tag teams up their sleeve that I'm not aware of that they can use to boost these divisions are dying. They're dying on the vine. So either fix it, and I don't see an easy solution to that, or unify the belt and have floating champions. It's very simple. Bobby Lashley, he defends the United States Championship against Apollo Crews. I referred to this on the prediction stream on Thursday. This is WWE's version of Apollo 13. This will be the 13th straight match that Apollo Crews has had on television against a member of the Hurt Business. And I am just about ready to see this guy move on to something else. I think he probably is ready to move on to something else too. I think everybody involved is probably ready to move on to something else. This is WWE's version of Apollo 13. Hopefully we will not get number 14. Bobby Lashley will retain, and hopefully we can finally be done with this. Bayley defends her SmackDown Women's Championship against Nikki Cross. Bayley's been cutting some promos on TV lately. Talking about Sasha. She was talking about Nikki the other day. These two had a whole series of title matches over the summer. Bayley retained her title every single time. 2-3 straight matches, however many it was. And this is the one that I struggled with the most, I think, of every match on this card. This was the one that I have struggled with, because this really could go either way. I could see them having Sasha Banks come back early. I mean, she's going to be back soon anyway, because they're going to be building to a match with her and Bayley at Hell in a Cell. But maybe they send Sasha out there and to kind of stick the knife in, Sasha will cost Bayley the championship. Well, I don't know why she would want to do that, because if she wants a match with Bayley, then she should want Bayley so she can take the title from her and not somebody else. But maybe we see a Sasha Banks appearance tonight, and she costs Bayley the title. Nikki Cross, with the assist, finally wins it. Then they go off and do something for the title with Nikki and Alexa Bliss. I don't see it going down that way, though. I think Bayley retains. I think that's absolutely the way to go. Bayley now is 350, I think, somewhere in the range of 350 days. Almost a full year. as the SmackDown Women's Champion. You've come this far. You have a long run like that, and you've got this story that she's involved in with her now ex-best friend. How are you going to take the title off of her now? You got to go all the way with it. And whether that's Hell in a Cell, whether you can hold off until WrestleMania, the big climactic win when her run comes to an end should come at the hands of Sasha Banks, not Nikki Cross, not Lacey Evans, not Naomi, nobody else. Story is there for Sasha. Do they need the title? They don't need the title, but I think the story needs the title. Everything that these two have been involved in for the entire year, for the entire summer, has revolved around championships. Bayley's title, Sasha won the Raw title, they won the tag team titles back. It's about the championships. And you take the championship out before the story has concluded, and to me, it weakens the story, and it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. So you got to keep that title on Bayley. I'm hoping that she retains. I expect her to retain tonight. Shayna Baszler and Nia Jax, they defend their the WWE Women's Tag Team titles against the Riot Squad. They're facing a Raw team. Liv Morgan and Ruby Riott are members of the Raw roster. So that's the championship match tonight. Ruby and Liv, they've been building a while. You know, remember when Liv was on that losing streak and Ruby had a losing streak of her own? She went 0-12 or something before she finally started winning matches. So now they've built them up to the point where they're getting a championship match. Shayna and Nia just won the belts. I know they're the odd couple team. They don't like each other. It's only a matter of time before things fall apart, but it just seems too soon. And the Riot Squad may yet win the belts, but I don't think tonight's the night. So I think Shayna and Nia pick up the win here, or at least they retain. They retain their titles. We've got Jeff Hardy, AJ Styles, and Sami Zayn. Triple threat match, ladder match for the Intercontinental Championship. They decided to give the match away on Friday night, minus the ladder stipulation. They gave us a triple threat. Sami Zayn stole the win from AJ Styles after AJ had knocked out Jeff with the phenomenal forearm. He threw AJ out of the ring, and Sami stole the pin. Now, even though Sami won, I predicted on Thursday a Sami Zayn win, and then I saw this the very next night. And WWE logic, and those are two words that don't really go together, but WWE logic would dictate that because of this, Sami is not going to win again. And because the parting shot in the segment was actually AJ standing on top of the ladder with both belts, that he ain't going to win. So it kind of looks like they're setting up for a Jeff Hardy win. And Jeff Hardy becomes the undisputed Intercontinental Champion. Now, they did add the stipulation that I pitched where it's winner take all with both belts hanging above the ring. Stipulation is very clear. You can only win when you pull both belts down. Not one. You got to pull both belts down. So I don't expect any kind of fuck finish here. One guy pulls one belt, the other guy pulls the other. They've made it clear. You can only win if you pull both belts down. They've got to get rid of that extra belt. Just have the one belt on TV. Sami's run was cut short. I know it was his choice to go home, but I still think that there's juice left in a run for him as the Intercontinental Champion. Now that he's back, I'd like to see him run with it for a little while longer. I'm sticking with my prediction. I am not changing it. I think Sami Zayn gets the win. I think Sami Zayn becomes the undisputed Intercontinental Champion. There is, again, the issue, the wild card here, and I mentioned this as well, that Jeff Hardy's rescheduled court date is scheduled for tomorrow. It was originally supposed to be, I think it was in April, and then it was delayed to July, then it was pushed back to September 28th, which is Monday. I've not heard that date has changed, but I don't see anybody else talking about it. I've seemed to be the only one who remembers this. So as far as I know, Jeff Hardy has a court date tomorrow. That's stemming from the last arrest on his record from late last year. We'll find out then what kind of penalty, if any, he may have to pay. Is it a financial penalty? Is he going to have to serve jail time? Is he going to get time served? Or is this just going to be pushed back again? It was delayed because of COVID last time. Maybe it gets delayed again. But you've got that wild card out there, not knowing what his status is going to be. In my mind, all the more reason to get the belt off of him, if you're not sure. Plus, I think Jeff can be, and I'll mention this in a second, but I think Jeff could be groomed to be a challenger for Roman Reigns. Roman is going to need some baby faces to run through over these next few months. Jeff could be that guy. So all the more reason to get the belt off him, give it back to Sammy. Drew McIntyre defends the WWE Championship in an ambulance match against Randy Orton. The ambulance match stipulation here gives them an out if they want to use it for beating Drew McIntyre without him actually being pinned. And if they want to do another match and have a blow-off with these guys at Hell in a Cell, Randy Orton was beaten at SummerSlam. Randy Orton was beaten by Keith Lee at Payback. If they want to come back and do one more match next month, Randy Orton's got to get a win. And so I'm picking Randy Orton to become the 14-time world champion. I think Randy Orton gets a victory here. I think he becomes the WWE champion to set up a rematch for Hell in a Cell inside the cell. I think that Keith Lee, there's a very good chance he gets involved here. I think we're going to see Keith Lee tonight. Maybe he pops out of the back of the ambulance, something like that. Because Keith Lee is as much a part of this story as Orton or McIntyre. But he's not involved in the match tonight. Not officially. But I think he will be. He probably will play into Orton getting the win, even maybe inadvertently. I think if they do the match next month, it's a triple threat. I think it's a three-way inside the cell with Keith Lee, Drew McIntyre, and Randy Orton for the championship. That's where I think this is going. Now, do I think Retribution is going to get involved? I'm going to say no. We didn't see Retribution at SummerSlam. We didn't see Retribution at Payback. I say just steer clear of things with them until tomorrow night. And Jey Uso, in the biggest match of his life, challenges Roman Reigns for the Universal Championship. I noted the other day that Roman did a Facebook Live Q&A, and he said that he will no longer be wearing the vest, the tactical vest that he's been wearing since the Shield debuted in 2012. He's ditching the vest. He goes, "You're not going to see me in trunks. I'm not doing that. I'm going to keep the black pants, but I'll probably have, you know, no vest, no shirt. It's going to be a bit of a new look for him." He also confirmed that he will at some point, not tonight, but at some point be debuting new entrance music. It will not be, he says, until something drastic happens. And the story unfolds. When something drastic happens and the story unfolds, when the time is right and he goes full-blown heel, is basically what he's saying. Full-blown sinister. That is when we will see new entrance music for Roman Reigns. And that's great. That's great. We're getting a new Roman Reigns. You got to change things up. That includes the look. That includes the music. Complete the package. Long overdue. I thought the closing segment from SmackDown on Friday night was fantastic. Roman Reigns telling Jey Uso that, "Look, I would give you the title if I could, but I can't because the family depends on me. Basically, I'm the breadwinner here. I'm the one they look to make the money, to put food on the table. I'm at the head of the table, not you, not anybody else." He goes, "You? You're just a twin. You rely on your brother. The family relies on me." And Jey Uso says, "Well, why can't it be me? You've been number one your whole life." Oh, there goes the big dog. There goes Roman Reigns. He goes, "You know what they say when they see me? Which one are you?" He goes, "After Sunday, they're going to know who I am. They're going to know that I'm the one who beat Roman Reigns for the Universal Championship." The fire in that man's voice. You could feel it. You could feel it. And they did one of these WWE, it was either an Untold or a Chronicle on the network on Jey Uso. You should check that out before the pay-per-view tonight. It is very good. It's very well done. I really love the way they've built this matchup. So anyway, Jey says that. Roman walks out. And as Uso is leaving, he's walking up the aisle. Roman, out of nowhere, comes back out, hits him with a Superman punch. It was a little weird because he hit him with one Superman punch and Jey was completely out. Like, did he wrap a chain around his fist or something? Because I've seen this guy give people 4, 5, 6 Superman punches in one match and they get right back up. So that was a little weird, but he knocked him down with a Superman punch, and this was my favorite part of the whole thing. Roman is just angry. He's full of rage. He kneels down right next to Jey, holds the championship over him, and he's yelling at him. He goes, on Sunday, you're going to take the payday. You're going to take the ass whooping that comes with it, but you will never take this title away from me. Because our family needs me to have this. You're going to take this away? You're going to try to take this away from me? He goes, you will never replace me at the head of the table. This was awesome. This was fantastic. Love that ending to SmackDown. On Thursday, I asked the question. I said, what's next after this is over? What's next for Roman Reigns? Well, you know what? Because I was saying, is it Big E? Is it Matt Riddle? Is it Daniel Bryan? You know, the Fiend has not forgotten. If you saw the little tease on Friday with Alexa Bliss, that's still there. But after watching this, I think Jey Uso may have earned himself one more match. Possibly inside Hell in a Cell. Maybe keep this story going for another month. If it's not, you know, total destruction, I think Jey is going to get killed tonight. But if it's not a complete and total destruction, injury angle, that kind of thing, I don't know, maybe they can get another month out of it. Maybe they can get another 4 weeks out of this. That's how much I've enjoyed this. But there's no doubt about who's winning tonight. It's Roman Reigns. Roman Reigns is going to retain. Roman Reigns is going to retain. He's going to be the Universal Champion for a long time yet to come. I could see him being the champion straight on through WrestleMania. So those are my predictions for tonight. Again, join me live on YouTube immediately after the pay-per-view. We'll go through everything that happens on the show tonight live on YouTube. We've got another COVID outbreak to talk about, and this time it is not limited to just WWE. This time it is an NXT outbreak. Not a main roster outbreak, at least not yet. Training has been halted at the Performance Center for the time being, according to PW Insider. The belief from sources is that the outbreak began after an NXT talent threw a party that fellow trainees attended, which led to an asymptomatic transmission of the virus that then spread to others who work and train inside the PC. And if you follow some of these wrestlers on social media, Instagram, men and women who work down there, you can tell the ones that really don't take any of this stuff seriously. You could tell. You could tell from the ones who do and the ones who don't. It's like they live in a whole world of their own. They don't live in the same world as everybody else. They live in their own little bubble, it feels like. Now, there was a report in this week's Observer that says one story going around is that one of the NXT coaches unknowingly spread it without having any symptoms. They didn't obviously know that they had it, but they were the one who may have spread it around. And that the usage of masks at the PC, apparently it's not really a secret, has gotten very lax. People have gotten very lackadaisical about utilizing masks inside the PC in recent weeks. How much of a goddamn idiot do you have to be to throw a party in the middle of a pandemic when you A, live and work in Florida, in Orlando, which is the hotspot right now for this stuff, and B, the nature of what you do for a living puts you in direct physical contact with other people. These are not people sitting behind a desk all day. These are not people driving an Uber. You train with people, there's sweat, you're rolling around, you're breathing on each other, you're in close contact, it's a direct contact sport. This is your job, this is what you do for a living, this is what they do for a living. And if they're doing the right thing and you're throwing a fucking party, that makes you a selfish asshole. If I'm WWE and people are getting a little too lax when it comes to wearing masks inside the PC, then it's time to start fining people. I mean, whatever happened to that? I thought Kevin Owens said that he had a whole conversation with Vince McMahon and they agreed to fine people for stuff like this. Or are they fining them $20 and nobody seems to care? You know, MLW just hired a COVID compliance officer for their company. I think it's time WWE does the same thing. Put somebody in place to actually enforce these things. And if people don't follow the rules, well, you know what? Maybe $500 here and $1,000 there, that might get their attention. These people are not millionaires. Not the ones who work down there aren't. $500 is a lot of money. $1,000 is a lot of money. It might not be a lot of money to Randy Orton, but to the people down there, that'll get their attention real quick. WWE issued this statement. As part of ongoing testing protocols, WWE completed its second round of weekly COVID testing on Tuesday. Individuals that tested positive will quarantine for 14 days, receive medical care, and will then only be cleared when they are symptom-free and test negative. Additionally, extensive contact tracing has been taking place, and other individuals have been placed in 14-day quarantine and will then only be cleared after they test negative. They did not release any names, which they are not obligated to do. If people don't want their names out there, then they have the right to not put their names out there. But if they want to, they may not feel that they can because WWE doesn't want them to. They had trainees from the PC. Some of the, not the main Retribution people, but some of those other people in the black masks who are just sort of the random hangers-on, the clingers, if you will, of Retribution. They were running around on Monday night in Retribution masks, working on Monday Night Raw. These are trainees from the PC who may well have been affected by this and didn't know that they had anything. If those people have COVID and didn't know it, they could have infected people on Raw. That could wreak havoc with their shows going forward. They have a pay-per-view tonight. I mean, this could still turn out to be an even bigger story if that happened. And we find out about more positive tests. It's already caused changes with the NXT shows. We don't know who may have tested positive outside of Chelsea Green going public and saying that she recently had it and now she's okay. You know, Chelsea Green is dating Matt Cardona, who's worked dates recently for AEW, which has not been spared in this either. By the way, you had the governor of Florida on Friday ordering a complete reopening, 100% complete reopening of all restaurants, all non-essential businesses, no restrictions, no restrictions. Florida also happened to have the highest COVID-related death count in the country on Thursday, just putting that out there. Where's that Bugs Bunny gif when you need it? That may be my favorite gif on the internet. I've used it more in the last 6 months than I have in the last 6 years. Lance Archer. This is where AEW comes into play. Lance Archer pulled himself from Dynamite this past week. There was a big six-man tag team main event planned. It was going to be Lance Archer, who was the number one contender for the AEW world title. Brian Cage and Ricky Starks taking on Jon Moxley, Darby Allin, and Will Hobbs. Newcomer Will Hobbs. This is going to be a big moment for him. That was the scheduled main event. It did not take place. Instead, they did an AEW world title match between Jon Moxley and Eddie Kingston, who, remember, was never officially eliminated from the Battle Royal at All Out. So him getting the shot actually made sense. And I was happy for Kingston to see him get that spot. 18 years in the business, the man was selling his gear a few months ago just to try to pay his mortgage. And there he was on TNT getting an AEW championship match. It's a great story. But Lance Archer pulled out because he claimed that when he got home from the last set of tapings, a family member was sick. And he was exposed, and then subsequently he tested positive. They didn't say that on TV, but in the tweet that Archer posted, he flat out said that he tested positive. And he said, "I'll see you in 2 weeks." Because that's when his AEW title match is scheduled for, maybe a little over 2 weeks. October 14th is the big AEW Dynamite live anniversary show. 1 year anniversary of Dynamite. He's in the main event challenging Jon Moxley for the championship. And he's hopeful that he'll be one of the people who feel fine. And in a couple of weeks, he'll test negative and everything will be fine. Now, Archer may not have been affected at work, but others were. And it's probably not a coincidence that this is happening. Their outbreak coincides with this NXT outbreak. They're all situated down there in the same, not exactly the same neighborhood or anything, but they're hobnobbing together down there. We know a lot of the talents between the two companies are very friendly. Some of them are in relationships together. It's possible. It's possible the two outbreaks are related. We just don't know. We don't know for sure. You got poor Ben Carter, 23 years old. He just had the biggest week of his life. He had great matches with Lee Johnson on AEW Dark. He had a great match with Scorpio Sky on Late Night Dynamite on Tuesday. He announced that he has tested positive as well. He doesn't know how he got it, where he got it, when he got it, but he's positive. So imagine going from like the highest of highs and then getting punched in the gut. So that was just shitty to hear. But this Dynamite anniversary show, I got to talk about this. October 14th is their big anniversary show. They are promoting Jon Moxley against Lance Archer for the main event. Jon Moxley has been announced. He was just announced for Josh Barnett's Bloodsport show 3 days before on October 11th. He's going to be facing Chris Dickinson. Moxley was originally supposed to face Josh Barnett last September. That didn't happen. He was supposed to face him again in April or be on the show in April. That didn't happen. Moxley had to pull out the first time due to the staph infection that he had in his elbow. This year's show got delayed due to COVID. Now, Moxley had to get approval from AEW to do the show, obviously. I think that is a huge mistake. One of the problems with allowing your talent to work outside dates, which is very nice of AEW to do, but in the middle of a pandemic, it is a disaster waiting to happen. And who knows, it may have played a role in the current outbreak that they're dealing with. How are you going to allow your world champion 3 days before your big anniversary show to work an independent date from another promotion with other talent not being tested by your company? I know AEW has all these protocols in place. You can have all the testing protocols in place and that you want down there in Jacksonville. But they have no power over the people who are working the Bloodsport show in Indiana. You know, Deonna Purrazzo just pulled out of that show, citing health concerns and wanting to make sure that she leaves enough time to self-isolate just to make sure that she's good to go for Bound for Glory weekend. You know, right now she is the Impact Knockouts champion, and she wants to make sure that she doesn't miss that show. If I'm Don Callis and Scott D'Amore over at Impact, I would have insisted on it. Maybe they did. Maybe that's why she pulled out. It's the smart thing to do. You know, I understand that Jon Moxley, he's a man of his word. He feels bad. He wants to keep his commitment to Josh Barnett. He promised that he was going to be part of the show. This would have been the third time that he would have postponed if he said no. But AEW has to be his top priority right now. After all this, I mean, Tony Khan, I think he's crazy. I think he's crazy for allowing Moxley to do this. Now, maybe Moxley's contract allows for him to call his own shots. I don't know. But this is not a risk worth taking so close to that anniversary show. I mean, honestly, if we're being honest here, I think AEW should tell all of its talents no more independent dates for the time being. Now, maybe some of the wrestlers aren't paid as much as the big names are, because they make a lot of their money from those indie dates, and that would hurt a lot of them. I don't know what their contracts say, but AEW has to lock this shit down and protect their own ass here. I know that allowing them to work outside dates is one of the things that makes AEW very attractive to a lot of the talent. WWE does not allow that. But, I mean, these are once-in-a-lifetime type circumstances here that nobody in wrestling could have foreseen. Now, maybe there's some kind of incentive or bonus or something that AEW can offer to some of these talents who, you know, can show that, hey, I was booked here, here, and here, and you're putting me in a tough spot here. You're telling me I can't work these shows. That's money out of my pocket. How are we going to fix this? Maybe there's something AEW can do, you know, temporarily to kind of cover them for that. But again, in my mind, it's just too risky. And when they feel it's safe enough, they can let those talents start taking outside bookings again. But the fact that the AEW champion is booked on this show 3 days before his big anniversary, you know, date with Lance Archer, to me, is a big mistake. The two biggest things promoted on Raw last Monday, if you watch that show, were Retribution and Braun Strowman against Yabba Dabba Doo Guy on Raw Underground, neither of which have anything to do with the pay-per-view tonight. So as a go-home show, Raw was a complete failure on Monday night. As a television show overall, that Raw show Monday night was a complete abject failure. Braun Strowman knocked out Dabba Kato in their match. Fight? I don't even know what you would call it. Strowman is coming off a run as the Universal Champion. He's the established guy. So him winning, I mean, I thought they might give the new guy a win, but Strowman winning didn't shock me. The surprise to me is that they had him knock the big guy out cold. This was a decisive win over Dabba Kato, which to me was a total waste of time. This entire show felt like a giant waste of time. This was one of the worst Raw shows all year. We learned that Retribution, this has been the subject of conversation all week. Retribution, the main five members anyway, have officially been signed to WWE contracts. Yes, the same Retribution that has been destroying property, beating people up, terrorizing the company. They have been rewarded with contracts. Dominik Dijakovic on Twitter, he tried to explain the unexplainable by saying that the company is paying them because they were tired of paying security guards to do a job that they were failing at, and they decided to pay them because they were successfully destroying the company regardless, and so they figure, well, if we have these guys under contract, then we can control them, we can manage their chaos. He said, stop overthinking literally everything. It's one thing to overthink things. It's another thing to literally not put any thought into anything because you're too lazy to. I'm sure WWE would love that. If every fan just stopped overthinking everything they did, they wouldn't have to answer for any of their stupid ideas. The only way to make sense out of this. Now, this whole thing feels to me like they're just kind of throwing shit at the wall to see what sticks. And they wanted something similar to the NWO, similar to the Nexus, to get people talking, to get people excited. Oh my God, it's an invasion. Maybe it'll bump the ratings up a little bit. That feels to me like more than having a long-term vision for this, that's what this feels to me. Now, if I'm wrong, then their long-term vision is going to pay off with some big reveal. There's going to be some big twists, some big swerve here coming in the weeks ahead, and we'll see. We'll see if they make me eat my words and if it plays out that way. But that's not what this feels like to me. So I'm going to tell you the only way to make sense out of all this is to find that either Triple H is the mastermind behind this, and it's the start of some kind of angle where he is trying to take over from Vince McMahon, or it's Shane McMahon, who has been secretly engineering this whole thing from the beginning, and somehow this ties in with Raw Underground. Raw Underground just so happened to sprout up out of nowhere on the very same night, I think, that we saw the first appearance by Retribution. That all happened on the same night. Maybe that wasn't such a coincidence. Maybe I'm giving this more thought than they have. Those are the only two ways to kind of work this angle where them getting contracts and all that could possibly make any sense at all. Hey, Dio Madden is part of this group. Dio Madden was in the crowd for some of those early Raw Underground segments too, banging on the mat. He was there. But that's the only way to make sense of why these people would be offered contracts after firebombing a power generator, terrorizing the entire roster, destroying the production truck, taking the show off the air, taking baseball bats and chainsaws to their property. Yes, let's reward these thugs with contracts and pay them. And it's a lose-lose situation, even if it was Shane, because we already had Shane McMahon overkill on TV last year. Nobody was begging for more Shane McMahon on TV. What we saw on Monday night was an embarrassment. If you're a wrestling fan, I don't see how you can classify what we saw Monday night as anything but an embarrassment. And if you think that they're well-intentioned, and well, you know, in the past, the company has tried to come up with interesting gimmicks for people who may be on their own or not so interesting, because look at who's in the group, Shane Thorne. When I would see Shane Thorne on NXT, I didn't give a shit. So could this be a positive thing in the end for Shane Thorne in some weird way? Who knows? Maybe it can be. because Shane Thorne wasn't doing it for me in NXT. Dijakovic, you could say that he's vanilla or he's this or that. Dijakovic is a very good athlete who was going out there having very good matches. You could have come up with any number of ideas for him as a babyface, as a heel, tweak the character a little bit without going to this degree, which is so far over the top that I can only hope that over time he can wash the stink of this off himself and just redeem himself and go on to have a successful career. This is the kind of gimmick, depending on how long they drag this out for, that could be a career killer. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that all these guys are done, stick a fork in them and get rid of them now because they're toast, because I don't believe that to be true. There's always a way to redeem yourself and try to come back. There's always a road back. But it's almost like they're doing things and these people have to work in spite of what the company is doing to try to overcome, like they're throwing barriers and obstacles in their way. They're dodging boulders, falling down from the side of the mountain. Dominik Dijakovic is now called T-Bar, which is short for Terrorize, Brutalize, Annihilation, Retribution. He's out there with a knockoff Bane mask covering his head. He shaved his head. He's got makeup underneath. Dio Madden is now called Mace, which is honestly probably the best name of the bunch. I actually don't have an issue with Mace. Mace is fine to me. I thought Dio looked the most intimidating out of all of them. He's got a presence about him. He's got the long hair. He's a big guy. He's got those eyes. Those eyes were all wide and stuff. He's got, his mask is probably cooler than the other ones. I actually thought that Dio, out of all of these goofballs we saw on TV Monday night, looked the best. Or if any of them were intimidating, it was probably Dio out of all of them. Then you got Shane Thorne, who I just mentioned. Shane Thorne is now being called Slapjack. Now, I'll spare you the Urban Dictionary definitions. I'm sure you've already seen it a million times this week. This entire group, between the Urban Dictionary definitions of some of these names and the way they look and sound and everything, I honestly truly wonder if this was, and I don't know if it was Bruce Pritchard, I don't know if it was just somebody else behind the scenes, it just comes off to me as someone who is trying to amuse themselves, like it's one giant rib that's now playing itself out on TV. And now it's up to them, it's up to these guys to try to get this thing over. Slappy's out there. He's got a Jason Voorhees hockey mask on his face. Mia Yim has a mask on like something out of Silence of the Lambs. You can clearly see it's Mia Yim. She's now going by the name Reckoning. Mercedes Martinez is going to be called Retaliation. That may be one of the worst ring names I've ever heard. When you say it, it doesn't even work. That sounds like the name of a faction. Not the name of a wrestler. If you're going to go with old school 80s names, yeah, and on occasion here on this show, I've advocated, oh man, I miss the days of Axe and Smash and Hawk and Animal, but those were fucking cool names, man. I had one person say, but haven't you argued that before? Yeah, I have, because those were actually badass names. You're going to compare Axe and Smash and Hawk and Animal to fucking Slapjack? At least try to come up with something cool. Remember the American Gladiators? They had all the different seasons of American Gladiators. They'd bring in different men and women. Like some of the women they had, we had Blaze. I think Nitro is one of them, actually. But we had Blaze, we had Jade, we had Fury. Now we have Slapjack and Retaliation. But I meant what I said on Twitter Monday night when I first saw all this go down. I said they look and sound like a group that the Shredder would yell at for letting those damn turtles get away. It's like something out of a cartoon out of the late 80s. They're out there looking like a bunch of trick-or-treaters. It's only September. Halloween is not for another month. They're not here for retribution. They're here for candy. Here's a Tootsie Roll. Now get the fuck out of here. It's no wonder wrestlers in the back were openly laughing They were laughing at these people during the show. And they felt bad for them too, because it, you know, in some cases, they're friendly with some of these people. They know people like Mia Yim and Mercedes Martinez, and they actually were openly feeling badly for the mountain that they are now going to have to climb. WrestleVotes talked to one source that said the masks and the names were already making the road for these guys impossible to climb. He said one of the female names that thankfully got scrapped, that doesn't look like they're going to use, although I can't say that Retaliation is much better, but one of the names they ditched was Shatter. They were going to call one of the women Shatter. Shitter would be more appropriate, which is where this entire angle belongs. You've got Mia Yim out there as part of the same group that cost her boyfriend Keith Lee a championship match last week, which means yet again they are going to completely retcon everything we were told about these people on NXT, because now it's Raw. It's Raw and SmackDown. So what happened in NXT doesn't matter anymore. And this is one of the things that really annoys me about this. I'm not saying that every little thing that happens in NXT has to be mentioned or followed up on the main roster, but to completely ignore it time and time and time again the way they do. You know, you may have been able to do that years ago, but now NXT airs on the same network that airs Monday Night Raw. This is no longer just a network show. This is a USA Network show every Wednesday night, the same USA Network that airs Monday Night Raw. And how many interviews have we heard Triple H give in the last year, 2 years, when this question comes up? How do you view NXT? Is it developmental? Is it its own brand? And Triple H has said it's no longer developmental. It is his own third brand. Well, if that's the case, then you need to stop treating the fans like idiots and give us some consistency here. They bring these people up and they just want you to forget everything that you saw of them on NXT. It's like they never existed. Then why invest time in watching NXT? Now these people have started Twitter accounts. T-Bar has a Twitter. Mace has a Twitter. Slapjack. They started their own Twitters, where they rebranded their existing Twitters, whatever they did. And they're trying to be entertaining and witty, and they're posting all these witty tweets online. Just because they're doing that doesn't make this suddenly a good idea. What they're trying to do is probably salvage this shit that they have been given. But all the tweets in the world aren't going to matter. What matters at the end of the day is what we see on TV. Becky Lynch was as good as anybody when it came to her Twitter game, and it really enhanced the character. But Becky Lynch didn't get over on Twitter. Becky Lynch got over on television, and Twitter just kind of enhanced everything. And she had somebody to go back and forth with in Ronda Rousey on Twitter, and that got people very excited. It was entertaining. But there's got to be an element on TV with the promos and the matches that gets people interested in these guys, and that just hasn't happened so far. So you can post all the twitty, I don't even know what I'm saying anymore. You can post all the witty tweets in the world, twitty, witty, shitty. Post all the tweets you want. Doesn't matter how witty they are. That does not make this a good idea. This is shit. And it's not going to last very long. They may try to build something in Survivor Series with this. I could see them wanting to do something with the Raw roster against Retribution. I give them until Survivor Series before the names change or the look changes or they drop the whole gimmick. If there's a draft, maybe they'll end up breaking them up and some of them will go to SmackDown. Drop the silly gimmick, try to salvage their careers on that brand. These guys deserve better. The Retribution stuff has been the epitome of wrestle crap so far. Just when I thought it couldn't get any worse, they somehow managed to top themselves this week. They also had them wrestle their first match on TV. They wrestled the Hurt Business, so we got heel against heel in the main event. And it ended when T-Bar, who was not the legal man, he was on the apron. He struck Lashley or he went to give him a thumb in the eye. And this resulted in a disqualification. The only people who should be wearing masks over their faces are Vince McMahon and Bruce Pritchard. They should both be forced to wear brown paper bags over their heads with little frowns drawn on in magic marker. You know who doesn't need to wear a bag of shame over his head? Chris Van Vliet. Take a listen to this.
Hey, it's Chris Van Vliet. You may have seen my videos on YouTube, but I also have a podcast.
It's Chris-a-mania, brother.
Each week, I sit down with the biggest names in pro wrestling for in-depth conversations to find out what makes the greatest performers so great.
That's a great question. Look at you, man, with the powerful questions.
Just search for the Chris Van Vliet Show wherever you're listening right now.
Ladies and gentlemen, Chris Van Vliet!
Go give a listen to Chris's podcast. He's got a great show. I'm sure you've seen a lot of the interviews that he's done. He's done some big ones recently. You got to interview Andrew Yang, former presidential candidate. Thunder Rosa, who's been making a lot of appearances of late on AEW. Thunder Rosa has been everywhere. She's been defending her NWA Women's Championship. And that was a great interview that he did with her. She's a total sweetheart. And even WWE stars like John Morrison. So go ahead and check out Chris's show. SmackDown on Friday night. I said earlier it was like night and day between Raw Monday night and SmackDown on Friday. I thought SmackDown was a very enjoyable show on the whole. They did give away the three-way 2 days early between Sami Zayn, AJ Styles, and Jeff Hardy. I don't like when they do that. But as a match, it was good. It was sort of a little appetizer, I suppose, for what we can expect with ladders thrown in tonight. Bayley cut another promo, seated in the chair on stage this time. She was not sitting in the ring. Talking about Nikki Cross and her big championship match tonight at Clash of Champions, but also, you know, dropping some more digs in there at Sasha Banks, still very quietly sort of in the background, building that story up. That's the bigger story. But her immediate concern is Nikki Cross at Clash of Champions. But she was talking about what she did to her best friend. When talking about, hey, Nikki, what do you think I'll do to you if I did this to Sasha? And she kind of picked up the chair and looked at it and said, right, Sasha? So I think Bayley's promo work has been good. I think Bayley's promo work, I don't look at Bayley as being a great promo. She's not a great promo, but she's been good. I think where she really shines is during the Golden Role Model stuff, when she was playing off Sasha, when she was coming out and mocking Michael Cole. They were doing the joint interviews, and it was kind of a mix of just being funny, but being the obnoxious heel. That's really, I think, where Bayley has shined. These sort of soliloquy, Bayley by herself, deep, serious type promos, they're good. I wouldn't call them great. Matt Riddle just cannot rid himself of Baron Corbin. I thought this issue was over. After their match, I guess it was Payback, was it, when they had their last match. This issue is far from over. So they rekindled their feud again on SmackDown Friday night. They had a match, and I thought to myself, here we go again. Why is Matt Riddle, when it seemed like he was kind of moving beyond this, why are they now linking him back up with Baron Corbin? And I still don't have a good answer for you, but I watched the match. And look, I can't hate when I see a good match. I can't hate on that. I thought these two had a very good match. I enjoyed this match. I enjoyed the match between Baron Corbin and Matt Riddle. Corbin hit a pretty cool looking deep six on an exchange with Matt, twirled him around, dropped him with the deep six for a near fall. And Riddle rallied. He was making a big comeback. Corbin caught him. He went for the end of days. Riddle flipped through it. And he blasted Corbin right in the face with a knee. Riddle went for the floating bro. And Corbin got his knees up. Corbin hit the end of days. And he scored the pin clean in the middle. 1, 2, 3. You know, with Brock Lesnar no longer being under contract, I can't really put the F5 on there anymore. But certainly on SmackDown, the two most protected finishers in this company, consistently protected finishers. Number one is Sheamus's brogue kick. You will rarely, if ever, find anybody kicking out of the brogue kick. He hits one of those things, you're done for. They have protected that move for years. The other move is the end of days. And they have protected those two things like gold in Fort Knox. When he hits it, nobody kicks out. And I could appreciate that because I wish more finishers were treated that way. Unfortunately, the brogue kick in the deep six, or not the deep six, the brogue kick in the end of days, it's a short list, I feel like, of finishers that are actually protected these days. Lacey Evans had a match with Alexa Bliss. You kind of knew where this was going. In the middle of the match, a couple different times, the lights flickered, the lights would go out, the Fiend's red light came on. When the Fiend's red light came on, everything turned red, the music played, and then it stopped, and Alexa Bliss was back in her trance. It was like she was, her body was taken over by the Fiend. And she attacked Lacey Evans. She was beating the hell out of Lacey Evans. She started stomping on Lacey Evans and wouldn't stop. And so the referee threw the match away. Yes, the disqualification for a kicking too much ass finish. I never would have expected that Alexa Bliss would be the one who would be kicking too much ass, so much so in a match that she would be disqualified. That is not the kind of finish I ever would have expected Alexa Bliss to be part of, unless she was the one getting her ass kicked. So she got disqualified. She took Lacey outside, hit another Sister Abigail. And as she's leaving, Roman Reigns' music hits. And out comes Roman Reigns and Paul Heyman. So they sort of cross each other. And Roman stops and he holds up the Universal Championship. And Alexa, who just has this disheveled look with her hair, I don't think she was wearing any makeup or very little makeup. She's got this scowl on her face. She stops. And she turns and she just stares at Roman. She's staring at Roman Reigns holding up the Universal title. And I'm thinking, well, we know who Roman's next challenger is going to be inside Hell in a Cell. It's going to be Roman Reigns against Alexa Bliss next month. Or, more likely, this is one of those little seeds being planted because the Fiend is not done with Roman Reigns. And Alexa Bliss is sort of, I guess, become a minion of his and she's under his spell. I like that. That's one of those little subtle but not so subtle things. It was brief. I mean, they didn't quite beat you over the head with it, but they were kind of, you know, showing Alexa. They wanted you to know what this meant. This was not done for no reason, but I liked it. It's just a little reminder that the Fiend is still lurking. The Fiend will get his rematch at some point. For the Fiend's sake, hopefully it won't be for a few months because, again, we know how that ends, and it does not end well for The Fiend, but I am intrigued by what they are doing with Alexa. I know some people might find it a little goofy. Of course it is, you know, goofy. I mean, the whole Fiend character is goofy. You either take it for what it is, or you don't. Some goofy shit they do is too goofy even for me. Goofy was probably my least favorite of all the Disney characters. Not a fan of Goofy. But in this case, I like what they're doing here. I find it interesting. It's certainly more interesting than Alexa Bliss hosting a moment of bliss with her coffee cup. Like she's Kathy Lee Gifford. Who gives a shit? This at least is kind of intriguing to me. So Roman came to the ring. And Jey Uso came out. And this was the big finale to the show. Roman was talking, and I talked a little bit about this earlier. I'll just go through this real quick. But he was basically explaining to Jey, he goes, you have no idea the responsibility involved in carrying this championship, the weight of this championship. He goes, you can't understand because you're a twin. You've depended on your brother your entire life. And he goes, look, I'm going to be the one who provides for this family. That's just the way it is. It's going to be me. It's not going to be you. He goes to walk out. And Jey Uso takes the microphone. He says, well, what if you're wrong? Why can't I be the one to provide for the family? I like this idea, by the way, that it's just, they don't have their own families. It's just one big Samoan family. They live in like a fucking compound. One big compound. They're all just kind of bunched up there together. And there's just one person working and providing for this entire just gigantic Samoan clan. That's kind of what it sounds like. Why? Does Roman provide for Jey Uso's family? I mean, I don't know. It's kind of strange. But Jay says, look, why can't it be me? Why can't I be the one? Why can't I be the provider here? You know, and he had that great line about when people look at you, they think there goes Roman Reigns, the big dog. When people look at me, they think, which one are you? Which one of the Uso twins are you? There are people who still can't tell them apart. I can. I there's just little subtleties in their face. I could tell them apart. You know, it didn't take long for me to be able to tell them apart. I could tell Nikki and Brie. I mean, now, of course, now I can. But even at the beginning when Nikki and Brie were more, more proportioned similarly, you look at their face and it was pretty obvious who was who. Earl and Dave Hebner. I could always tell them apart just because Dave Hebner had a chubbier face than his brother. But there are people who still can't tell them apart. Who look at them and go, which one is Jay and which one is Jimmy? And anybody who has an identical twin, this could be a story that maybe they can relate to. But the way that he gave this promo, and again, the fire and the passion in his voice, the way he delivered this, I thought was just pitch perfect. And Roman left, and when Jay left, Roman came back out, hit the Superman punch, and was just yelling at him. And I have to say, Roman Reigns, his facial expression game has been 10 out of 10 ever since this change in character. They zoom in on his face when he's angry. I mean, I think what is working so well so far about this is just the fact that this is the Roman Reigns that I think people have wanted for a very long time. They did not want Roman Reigns to be the guy who walked out there and just was all smiles all the time, cracking jokes that maybe were only half, funny half the time. It just felt forced. It just felt like, all right, he's kind of filling the role that John Cena used to have. He's now the new John Cena. That's not what Roman Reigns was supposed to be. Roman Reigns was supposed to be what he was in the Shield. He was the ass kicker. He was the enforcer. He was the guy who looked cool. He didn't have a lot to say. He went in there. He speared people in half. That's what people wanted out of Roman Reigns. They didn't want the version of Roman Reigns that they were being spoon-fed. Unfortunately, he bore the brunt of it because, a lot of the fans blamed him. It wasn't his fault. But this guy went away for 6 months. He came back. You could tell he dropped weight. Look at the guy. Look at his arms. Look at his face. He got the veneers. But he dropped weight. He's more cut. He's kneeling down beside Jey Uso. He's got veins bulging out of his arms. He's got this look on his face like he's just pissed at the world. But when that camera zooms in, it's almost like Paul Heyman is afraid of him. He's afraid to get too close to him. And he's sort of keeping his distance from Roman because he's intimidated by him. He's with him. He's managing him, but he's almost afraid of his own guy. And he was kind of the same way with Brock Lesnar, but you had a reason to be afraid of Brock Lesnar. There were times where Brock Lesnar would manhandle Paul Heyman. He would grab him, he would choke him, he would throw him down. You talk about an abusive relationship. No wonder Heyman had to just get out of that relationship and go find somebody else to hang out with. Brock was very abusive to him. But what they've done so far with Roman Reigns, and it's only been about a month, but I want them to just continue on the path that they are on. I cannot criticize anything that they've done so far. And tonight, I think, will be the next chapter. Tonight will be the destruction of Jey Uso. I do think that as good as this has been, though, if they want to squeeze one more match out of this and get these guys inside the cell and really pay this off inside the cage, they could do that. They could do that. But that would mean a less dominant win or maybe some kind of a non-finish. Maybe, who knows, some kind of DQ or something. I don't know that would make people very happy. But there might be a way to do that if you want to squeeze that extra match out. But the whole reason this was done, whether they do it tonight, whether they do it at Hell in a Cell, can't lose sight of the fact that this is being done to solidify Roman Reigns as a heel. And if you are of the mindset that Roman Reigns is still not quite full 100% heel, he's maybe 80 or 90%, putting him in there with his own cousin and leaving his own cousin in a pool of blood would send a message that this guy, this is not the babyface Roman Reigns that we had 6 months ago. Because if he'll do this to his cousin, what's he going to do to everybody else on the roster? And I know some people are thinking we might see Jimmy Uso come out to try to help his brother, or Jimmy might get the next match. Jimmy Uso, he tore his ACL in April. Jimmy Uso ain't coming back until next year. Jimmy Uso is looking at January or February for a return. That sounds about right. A torn ACL is no simple injury. That's a major injury. It's not a swerve. He's not going to make us a shocking appearance tonight. So you can cross that off your list. You know, the one thing I didn't know about the Jimmy Uso ACL tear, I knew that he suffered it in the ladder match at WrestleMania where they picked one member of each team to have that ladder match. I think it was Kofi, John Morrison, and Jimmy, I think. He blew out his ACL in the first 3 or 4 minutes of that match. And it was on a spot where he kind of very slowly fell off or got knocked off one of the ladders from maybe 5 feet up. And he landed right on his feet. And you could see where his leg buckled. He said that that's where the injury happened. And that match probably went 15, 20 minutes. And he was climbing ladders and doing moves off the top and everything. He wrestled without knowing that he even had a torn ACL. He wrestled the majority of that match. I don't think he was actually diagnosed until 2 days later. Like, yeah, you tore your ACL. So who knows how much more damage he did wrestling the whole way through without even knowing. He knew something was wrong, obviously, but he didn't know that he tore his ACL. So long story short, Jimmy Uso ain't coming back for at least a few more months. But that was SmackDown on Friday night, a very enjoyable show, I thought. And I can't say that for SmackDown every week, but I will give that show its props when deserved. And if you're looking to go back on YouTube or something and watch certain parts of the show, if nothing else, watch the final segment with Jey Uso and Roman Reigns, because to me, that right there was the best segment that they have done yet in this story building up to Clash of Champions tonight. NXT delivered a solid, if unspectacular, effort on Wednesday with an excellent main event building to a takeover show that doesn't really feel like it needs to be happening. They could have built it up for Survivor Series weekend. Doesn't help that at least some of the matches they reportedly had planned for this takeover had to be changed due to people testing positive for COVID. Tom Phillips and Beth Phoenix did commentary for the show. There was no Vic Joseph. There was no Wade Barrett, who said, we were told that they had the night off, which was very odd. They also had no trainees in the crowd. They piped in crowd noise instead, I assume because of the outbreak. Candice LeRae won a women's battle royal to earn the right to challenge Io Shirai at TakeOver for the championship. So case in point, as far as them being shorthanded, we had a bunch of ladies in this battle royal, PC trainees, that have never made a single appearance on television before. They threw them in the battle royal. We had Gia, we had Ellie, we had Raven. No, not that Raven. But we had a bunch of women who I didn't know, nor did I care. Tegan Nox was in the back, clutching her knee, writhing around on the floor in pain before the match from an attack, we were told, by Candice. So Tegan never made it into the match. Now, the NXT, they put out an NXT injury report each week. And I think part or most of it, usually, not all the time, but a lot of times it's kayfabed. And in the NXT injury report, it said that Tegan was undergoing or going to be undergoing an MRI on her knee. And now people think that she tore her ACL again. There's this, I don't know where it started, but on Twitter, oh, you know, Tegan might have a torn ACL and she might be out for a year again. Again, these injury reports are usually kayfabed. I know they weren't in the case of Dexter Lumis when they said that Dexter Lumis was hurt, and he is, and that's why he's been off TV. Look, I suppose it's possible that she really did suffer some kind of minor knee injury, and they're playing it up like it's more serious, and they shot the angle to explain why she couldn't be in the Battle Royal. But if she retore her ACL, just think about this. If she retore her ACL, they would not have her shooting an angle, writhing around on the floor in pain, clutching the knee. So I'm going to say they're just scaring people into thinking that, you know, she, oh my God, she's hurt. They want people to think the worst. And that way they'll be surprised when she shows up at TakeOver and she costs Candice LeRae her match with Io Shirai. But if she really did suffer a third ACL tear, this would be her third ACL tear if this were actually true, then I'm sorry, I think her career is over. For all intents and purposes, her career is over. She may wrestle again, but her career is over. I don't believe there's any coming back from that. How do you come back from three ACL tears? How do you come back and expect that the company is ever going to trust you in a top spot if that's what you aspire for? And she was headed in that direction. Let's say hypothetically she really did re-tear her ACL, which I don't believe she did. If you're WWE, how do you ever really trust her body and her knees enough to hold up to put her in a top spot on Raw or put her in a top spot on SmackDown in the women's division? I don't see it. I mean, I've tried to avoid the injury-prone label with her before. She's had the two blown-out ACLs, a third one, and it's going to be hard not to call her injury-prone. So for her sake and her career, I hope that this is nothing more than just a storyline. That's what I believe it is. I have no reason to believe that this woman actually has a torn ACL. I think that's people letting their imaginations get the best of them. But the story of the Battle Royal was how many people could Rhea Ripley and Raquel Gonzalez eliminate. That's where the trainees came into play. They were easy prey. They were easy eliminations for both women. Finally, the two of them squared off. They ended up eliminating each other. Casey Catanzaro, she put her American Ninja Warrior skills on display. She did her best Kofi Kingston impression and avoided her feet touching the floor a couple of different times. She was like Spider Lady out there trying to climb on the barricade and jump onto the steps. The floor is lava. Anything but touching the lava. And ultimately, she got eliminated anyway. Came down to Candice and Shotzi Blackheart. I thought this was a bit of an innovative finish here. Candice was laid out flat on the ring steps outside. And Shotzi came out there with her, and Candice used her feet to monkey flip Shotzi Blackheart off the steps and onto the floor for the win. So Shotzi, she really impressed me with her match last week with Io Shirai. I really enjoyed that match. I thought that was the best Shotzi Blackheart match we've seen to date. But I knew she wasn't getting another match so soon after the first one. Rhea was my pick. Once she went out, and knowing that, you know, Tegan was not in this match, because I figured Tegan and Candice would basically cancel each other out. With Tegan being out, and once Rhea went out, it was pretty obvious to me who was going over here, which was Candice LeRae. Damian Priest beat Austin Theory. Good match. I think moving Austin Theory back to NXT was the best thing that ever happened to him. The best thing that ever happened to this kid's career was basically being, you call it demoted, I call it being promoted back to the NXT roster. It's where he belongs. Young guy, there's no place for him on Raw right now. There's no good spot for him on Raw right now, I'm sorry. I know he was part of the Rollins group and all that, but I don't trust those people to do the right thing by some of these young guys. He needs to be on NXT. He needs to stay down there for a while. He needs to have matches and just build his profile up more. Up his game a little bit. He's very good. He's got all the tools, I think, to be a main event star for this company years down the road. Why rush him to the main roster? I like his chances a lot better the longer he stays in NXT. And yeah, you know, he keeps losing to guys like Damian Priest and Bronson Reed. But he looks good every time he's out there, bumping around, flopping around like a fish. They're taking their time to build him. There was a weird vignette that played teasing the return of a former NXT star who is coming back to the Black and Gold brand with a date of October 4th, 2020, given at the end, which just so happens to be the date of the next TakeOver show. They were using a generic computer voice, this person was, to speak, to mask their real voice. Whoever this person was, it didn't even look like a person, it looked like a video game character. This looked like it was a controlled video game scene. And the person threw a spear, not a wrestling like Goldberg spear, an actual spear, threw a glass championship trophy case, the glass shattered. And the person walked over to the case. There were two different NXT championships on display in this case. They grabbed one of them. They aired this in night vision, so I couldn't tell which title it was, whether it was the NXT title, it could have been the NXT women's title, because they basically looked the same. If we are talking former NXT champions, everybody's been trying to figure out who is the mystery person, who's coming back. If we're talking solely former NXT men's champions, the only names that would really fit would be Bo Dallas, who is still employed. They fired Curtis Axel, but they kept Bo, and he's been off TV, I think, since December. He's been off TV a very long time. He has been off television. They could easily repackage him with a new gimmick if they wanted to. So Bo Dallas is one. The other possibility is Bobby Roode. Bobby Roode is said to be ready to return. He has been unable to return because he is Canadian, and he has been unable, I guess, to travel and cross the border, or maybe he didn't want to. So Bobby Roode is ready to come back any week now, and the expectation was that he was going to be coming back to Monday Night Raw. Well, what if he's not coming back to Raw? What if he's coming back to NXT? He's a former NXT champion. Could be him. I don't see how what we saw in this vignette would fit the Bobby Roode character at all. Unless they're completely repackaging him. See, Bobby Roode, I don't think needs to be repackaged. So this type of vignette doesn't really scream Bobby Roode. It doesn't fit. Samoa Joe is another former NXT champion. Again, I can't see it being Joe. I know he's been off commentary the last couple of weeks. I'm not going to speculate on why. I just can't imagine that Vince McMahon would allow him to just go back to NXT when they seem to value him on commentary. And if anything, they would want him back in the ring on Raw. So I would be very surprised if this turned out to be Samoa Joe. I don't think it's Samoa Joe. Of the men, I think it would be Bo Dallas. He's the likeliest. I ended up loving the Bo Dallas run there at the end before he left NXT. I mean, watching him be dragged out, kicking and screaming out of Full Sail is still one of my all-time favorite NXT moments. Then they get him in the golf cart. They're trying to, you know, drive him. He bites one of the security. He bites one of them. Probably gives him rabies. Runs away. This big chase ensues. Oh, Bo Dallas at the end there was just fantastic. He was great. He was great. If we can get that Bo Dallas back, you know what? I'm all for it. I thought that version of Bo Dallas was very entertaining. But that's also assuming that the person who's coming back is a man. We don't know that. It could very well be a woman. And there have not been as many NXT women's champions as there have been NXT men's champions. The only real option when I look at the list of former NXT women's champions, and Charlotte, I mean, this is not for Charlotte. Charlotte was already there anyway. Ember Moon is the only name on that list that really stands out to me as, oh yeah, she's been off NXT for a while. She's still under contract. She's been out with an injury. If she is ready to come back, it absolutely could be Ember Moon. Ember Moon throwing a spear. I don't know. To me, that kind of fits. So I think Bo Dallas on the men's side, Ember Moon on the women's side would be the most likely candidates for this spot. Her injury was really bad. I mean, the Achilles injury that she suffered was really bad. And even a few months ago, she was getting emotional when she was on that backstage show on Fox when she was talking about it. She wasn't sure she'd ever be able to come back. I mean, that's how, I don't say how badly her recovery was going, but she clearly was very frustrated with how her recovery was going. And she really was not sure if she would ever be able to come back. And again, think about how this all happened. It was on a stupid 24/7 chase. Didn't even happen in a match. She was chasing R-Truth and people to the back in the 24/7, the jobber chase they had her doing. And that's how she ruptured or whatever it was, ruptured the Achilles. It's a very serious injury. If she is ready to come back, that's fantastic news. And I think that, you know, maybe a little bit of time in NXT before she eventually comes back to SmackDown, maybe that would be good for her career. But again, that implies that her recovery has gone far better than it sounded like it was going even just a few months ago. So we'll see. We'll find out, I guess, October 4th. But if she was coming for Io Shirai's title, Io Shirai against Ember Moon in NXT, I'd like to see that. And Kyle O'Reilly will challenge Finn Balor for the NXT Championship at TakeOver, beating out Kushida, Cameron Grimes, Bronson Reed, and Timothy Thatcher in the first ever NXT Gauntlet Eliminator. Two men begin. Those two men were O'Reilly and Kushida. Every 4 minutes after a new person comes out, Royal Rumble style. Pinfalls and submissions only, not over the top rope. Bronson Reed was out third. Velveteen Dream ran in and hit Kushida with the Dream Valley Driver. And Reed splashed Kushida for the first elimination. So that now sets up Kushida. It is now official. Kushida will wrestle Velveteen Dream in a grudge match at TakeOver October 4th. Thatcher was out next. Cameron Grimes was the final person. O'Reilly eliminated Reed after a diving knee drop to the back. O'Reilly and Thatcher, they had an exchange of strikes. Watching those two together was a lot of fun. Thatcher kicked out of a backslide. O'Reilly rolled him up for the three count. So that left Kyle O'Reilly and Cameron Grimes. And I like that because those were the two people who I thought were the most likely to pull out the win. I thought it would be Cameron Grimes. But it could have been O'Reilly, it could have been Grimes. So I didn't know who was going to win. There was still doubt in my mind watching this as to who was going to win. Because shockingly, as usually everything gets spoiled for me because I don't get a chance to watch NXT until the next day. And so usually, I mean, sometimes that night in the chat when I'm doing the Dynamite stream, somebody will, you know, shoot their mouth off or something. But somehow I was spared. And any spoilers, and I did not know who was going to win here, and I'm glad I didn't, because I was guessing right up until the very end. And so, it came down to O'Reilly and Grimes, and in the end, Kyle O'Reilly locked on a knee bar for the tap out. This was an excellent main event. The Kyle O'Reilly push feels very sudden. Makes me wonder again how much of this maybe is due to them being a little shorthanded, but I endorse it. I endorse it. Balor and O'Reilly is going to be a kick-ass match. I see Kyle O'Reilly one day as being a fine intercontinental champion. Like one day on SmackDown, that's where I could see Kyle O'Reilly going. I don't see Kyle O'Reilly as the Universal Champion. But I see Kyle O'Reilly as a fine intercontinental champion one day. That's kind of where I see him at. He could be that guy. He doesn't have to be the tag team guy. He can have a very productive singles career for himself. And imagine him on that brand working with guys like Matt Riddle, working with guys like Sami Zayn, working with AJ Styles, or Daniel Bryan if Bryan comes back. WWE has announced a face-off between Balor and O'Reilly on TV this week, moderated by Shawn Michaels. Damian Priest and Io Shirai will take on Johnny Gargano and Candice LeRae. And Shotzi Blackheart goes one-on-one with Dakota Kai. So that is your NXT report. Some other random notes. Last week I mentioned the NXT UK TakeOver Dublin show that was delayed from April 26th to October 25th. With Hell in a Cell taking place now October 25th, that was not going to be possible anyway. And we got official word this week that the event has now been rescheduled for a third time. The Dublin TakeOver is now scheduled for Sunday, June 20th of next year. Here's hoping we get that Walter versus Finn Balor match at some point. The Undertaker did an interview with Barstool Sports. And he was asked if the Last Ride documentary was done as a way to officially announce his retirement from the ring so that he couldn't change his mind. That would be the exclamation point. Once it's public and they've acknowledged that, okay, I'm done, this is it, it would just make it that much harder for him to kind of change his mind and go back on his word. I mean, look, the freaking thing was called The Last Ride. So I would assume that was the idea going into it. He said that that was his thought process. He was thinking, you know, look, I don't move the way I used to move. It's a watered-down version of what The Undertaker used to be. That's not what I wanted to ever become. He said, it's like I needed somebody to put a bullet in there and put an end to it. That's where his head was at until it came time to show Vince McMahon the final 15 minutes of the final episode, and he said Vince did not like the ending at all, which is why that they had Undertaker decided to add the line in there about never say never in regards to a possible return. He says, obviously, as we get closer, I'm going to have that internal feeling like I should be getting ready for something as we get closer to WrestleMania season. And look, I understand that Vince McMahon is a promoter. At the end of the day, Vince McMahon is a promoter. And in his mind, he's probably thinking it's better to just leave it open-ended so people think maybe The Undertaker will come back. But there it is. I mean, if you had any doubt at all about why this man keeps coming back, Undertaker, if you give him the opportunity to keep coming back, he's going to say yes. He cannot say no. He cannot say no. If you push him, if you give him any reason, if you float a match possibility by him that he finds attractive, it's like if somebody is trying to like kick a smoking habit, or somebody is in AA meetings and they're trying to get off the sauce, and you keep like you're sitting next to them and you got a glass of scotch and you just keep pushing it towards them. Hey, here, take a sniff of this. Eventually, that person is probably going to cave. You're not doing them any favors. It's like a drug. So if there was ever any doubt about why this guy keeps coming back, money aside, Vince McMahon seems determined to drive this guy into the ground until he physically cannot walk to the ring anymore. And even then, they'll probably just put him in a wheelchair and send him all the way down the ramp. Remember how he drove the motorcycle down to the ring at WrestleMania X7? Here, let's put him in the wheelchair. Whee! They'll wheel the Undertaker all the way down to 80 yards, down to the ring. Hopefully they have one of those stoppers to stop him when he gets to the bottom of the ramp. Then he goes flying right into the ring under the bottom rope. That's how they're going to get the Undertaker into the ring. It could be years before they're even able to run full stadiums again. The guy will be almost 60 years old. The Boneyard match is as perfect an ending as he is going to get. Let the man rest in peace. Dwayne Johnson was on YouTube. He was asked if he were to ever come back to the ring, who would it make the most sense, business-wise, for him to wrestle? And he said that he would love to get into the ring with Roman Reigns. And he would be more than happy to put his cousin over. Now, Rock against Roman Reigns is a match that I did not really care to see, even a year ago. Let alone, I think, a couple of years ago is when I first got that mailbag question about it. And it just was not a match that I really had any interest in seeing. I was kind of over the whole Rock at WrestleMania thing. They had done all the big matches with The Rock. I wanted to see Rock and Triple H at 32, and it didn't happen, and I was just over it. And the match just didn't have any appeal to me. Especially that version of Roman Reigns that we had back then, the babyface, you know, smiley babyface Roman Reigns. I mean, the hell with that. I had no interest in that. This new Roman Reigns, though, screaming about being the tribal chief and being I'm the head of the table, I'm the head of the family. Look, there's no bigger name for him to get in there and beat in the family than The Rock. Only thing is, I don't see it happening. His schedule is just not going to allow it. There have been at least two different WrestleMania matches that he was rumored for. The one with Triple H and the tag match they wanted him for. It was going to be him and Ronda Rousey against Triple H and Stephanie at 34. And both times, it fell through. It never materialized. They couldn't make it happen because of his movie commitments or insurance issues, whatever it was. It was movie related. If it were up to him, I'm sure he would do it in a heartbeat. I don't think WWE can really commit to, you know, especially let's say Roman is the champion and that's going to be your title match at WrestleMania. I don't see how WWE can commit to a match like that only to have Rock be forced by some movie studio to pull out. And then Roman is left with no opponent. So I'm going to say it doesn't happen. It's a nice idea. I would be down to see it, but I just don't see it happening. And speaking of The Rock, this is very cool. It was announced earlier this year that Ken Shamrock, who has been back with Impact Wrestling since September of last year, he would be inducted into the Impact Hall of Fame over Bound for Glory weekend. Bound for Glory takes place this year on October 24th. Shamrock threw a Hail Mary pass on Twitter on Friday. He tweeted The Rock to see if he would be willing to record an induction message for him. I guess with everything, maybe this will be either a virtual Hall of Fame ceremony, or I guess they figure The Rock isn't coming in for anything. But if they could at least get him to record a video, like a cameo, Rock is going to do a cameo for Ken Shamrock, then at least then they can use that. So he said, let me tweet The Rock and see. I guess he wasn't connected to him where he could DM him. So he just posted a public tweet. Everybody could see it. He said, hey, brother, I'm being inducted into the Impact Wrestling Hall of Fame. I would be very grateful if you could send an induction greeting. After all, I believe my time with you was my greatest memories in wrestling. Thank you. And 90 minutes later, The Rock responded in the affirmative. He said, congrats, my brother. Awesome news. I will take care of this and get it to you by this weekend. So yes, The Rock will technically be making his Impact Wrestling debut, inducting Ken Shamrock into the Hall of Fame next month. I love seeing that. Rock was Shamrock's greatest rival during his time in WWE. They feuded over the Intercontinental title. Shamrock beat him in the finals to win the King of the Ring in 1998. The one moment I will never forget was the chair shot on Raw. Ken Shamrock took an unprotected chair shot right to the face, right to the head. One of the all-time, probably top two or three most devastating chair shots that I have ever seen. And I don't mean devastating in that it caused injury, he was all bloody. He wasn't. He was actually okay. But when you watch it and you listen to it, oh my, I mean that, I will never forget that. For as long as I live, I will never forget that chair shot. Now, the Undertaker chair shot to Mr. Kennedy, which I think may have been at the Survivor Series in 06 or 07 or something, that chair shot is probably maybe the sickest. And then the other one I think of is Jeff Hardy, the Jeff Hardy chair shot to Brock Lesnar's face in 2002. I will never forget the sound that that chair made. But Shamrock, he talked to Chris Van Vliet last year about the chair shot. And he said that he told The Rock, he was in the back with him earlier that day. And he goes over to The Rock and he says, look, brother, I want you to hit me in the face with the chair. And he had to fight him on it. The Rock is like, I'm not going to hit you in the face with the chair. He goes, look, trust me. I want you to just do it. Just hit me in the face with the chair. Rock's like, I'm not hitting you in the face with the chair. And finally, Shamrock was able to talk him into it. And Rock made it very clear to him. He said, look, he goes, I'm going to lay this shot in. And Shamrock said, good, that's exactly what I want you to do. So they finally, you know, they agreed to it and they go out there. And if you remember, Shamrock is on his knees and he's looking up at The Rock and he's kind of motioning. And he says what he was telling him was, you better lay it in. Like, don't hold back. You better lay it in. Because the thing that Shamrock says he hated more than anything were these weak-ass looking chair shots. So he's like, give it to me. You better lay it in. And The Rock laid it in. He swung that chair, he hauled off, and he whacked him right in the face. And if you watch it, at the very last second, Shamrock says he tilts his head forward. So the brunt of the blow would be absorbed by his forehead. He goes, you know, your forehead is the hardest bone in your body or the hardest bone in your head. So that's where he took the brunt of the shot. And he says he didn't get hurt at all. But he was thinking as he was laying there, he says, boy, am I grateful to be alive. Rock never really had a problem laying in those chair shots, did he? Doesn't seem like it. It doesn't seem like... Whenever I remember Rock giving chair shots to people, poor Mick Foley, he never really had an issue laying those chair shots in. It wasn't like one of those Lance Storm ECW chair shots that he's still mocked for to this day. Hulk Hogan couldn't swing a chair to save his life. But The Rock, Rock might have been the real chairman of WWE. But that was the first one. The second chair shot to the face that he gave Shamrock was every bit as brutal. Shamrock was having a match. I think it was on Raw against Farouk. It was one of the Nation members. And Rock came in and same thing. He hit him right in the face with the chair. Boom! Popped right off his face. I can remember the king cackling in the background. Shamrock is out of his mind. You'd have to be. Tell people to hit you right in the face with a chair, you'd have to be out of your mind. But also very underrated. I think very underrated. I don't think he gets the credit that he deserves as a wrestler. He'll be more remembered probably for his MMA career and some other things that he probably would not rather be remembered for, MMA-wise. But he was a pro wrestler before he was ever an MMA fighter. And he was pretty good at it. And I wish more people were either around when he was a wrestler, because they probably hear, like, newer fans or younger fans now, they're like, Ken who? You know, where they watch Impact and they see he's a lot older now. He's in his, you know, mid-50s probably. But Shamrock had a good run there for a few years. And don't ever forget, the reason we have tapouts now in WWE is because of Ken Shamrock. It wasn't until Shamrock came in that all of a sudden, all these submissions, it wasn't a matter of, like, verbally submitting anymore. It was the tapout. That was ushered in by Ken Shamrock.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, we got a whole bunch of them here for you, so we'll go all the way back here to start. 48 years ago this week, on September 27th, 1965, after a successful title defense at Madison Square Garden, the WWWF champion, Bruno Sammartino, he decided to go celebrate his win, as he normally did, by having dinner after the show at a restaurant in Times Square. When he got back to his car, though, he found that one of his car windows had been shattered and his championship belt had been stolen. And a police report was filed. The belt was never recovered. So whoever has it has themselves one hell of an eBay item. I know there was an NWA title from many, many years ago that somebody found in their attic, I think maybe about 9 or 10 years back. That was not the championship that was stolen from his car. That title, as far as I know, has never been recovered. 24 years ago this week, on September 22nd, 1996, WWE presented its Mind Games in Your House pay-per-view, which featured the in-ring debut of Mark Henry, the world's strongest man. He got a win over Jerry the King Lawler. And maybe the WWE match of the year, probably the match of the year, in 1996 between Shawn Michaels and Mankind for the WWF Championship. I put this match ahead of the Good Friends, Better Enemies match with Shawn Michaels and Diesel. And yes, I put this over the Iron Man match in terms of my enjoyment. I put this over the Iron Man match at WrestleMania. One of the best matches of Mick Foley's career. I think he has since said that he ranks the Randy Orton match at Backlash in 04 maybe as being his favorite, but this is either his favorite or one of his very favorite matches that he ever had. Now, it had a cheap DQ finish. That might be the only real blight on this thing, but the people went crazy for the chaotic finish at the end, and so did I. Then The Undertaker pops up out of the casket that was at ringside. What a great moment. What a great match. 23 years ago this week, on September 22nd, 1997, WWE held its first ever Monday Night Raw from Madison Square Garden, one of the more famous episodes of Raw, which featured the debut of Cactus Jack on WWE television. He beat Triple H in a New York City street fight. And Vince McMahon, this was the night that Vince McMahon ate his very first Stone Cold Stunner and proceeded to flop around like a fish. Didn't quite get down the selling of the stunner, but he tried. He tried. That very same night, over on TNT, Bill Goldberg made his WCW debut on Monday Nitro with a win over Hugh Morris, his first win on his march to the Georgia Dome in the match with Hollywood Hogan on Nitro, which took place less than 1 year after this. So imagine, this guy debuted on Nitro. Nobody knew who the fuck he was. And less than a year later, he was pinning Hulk Hogan in the main event on Nitro in front of 40,000 people to become the WCW champion. You talk about a quick rise. Brock Lesnar, Kurt Angle, Bill Goldberg. It's a short list of people who had the kind of rise in wrestling that these guys did. I love how they didn't even give him an entrance. Like, he was already standing in the ring when Hugh Morris got an entrance, because he was the star. Bill Goldberg was the unknown. He was already standing in the ring, hands on hips, just kind of stoically looking straight ahead. And the announcers proceeded to act as if they knew nothing about this guy. Mike Tenay, who is all about stats and knowing everybody's backgrounds, here's a guy who played for the Atlanta Falcons. It's just funny now to look back on it. And to hear Mike Tenay go, "We don't know anything about this Bill Goldberg guy." Oh, really? For Mike Tenay, of all people, to be saying that is very funny. I guess he's from parts unknown. Now his parts are known. But at that time, it was parts unknown. 21 years ago, on September 21st, 1999, at the SmackDown taping in Dallas, Triple H was forced to wrestle 5 times in one night, which sounds like a nightmare, and win 3 of those 5 matches in order to keep his spot in the six-pack challenge at Unforgiven. He lost to the Big Show in a chokeslam challenge. He beat Kane in an Inferno match. He lost to Midian and Viscera in a handicap casket match. He beat Mankind in a boiler room brawl. And he beat The Rock in a Brahma bull rope match to keep his spot. You talk about hot-shotting all of your gimmick matches on TV. We got a casket match, an Inferno match, a boiler room brawl. What else was in here? Casket, Inferno, boiler room, on a bull rope. All in one night. Talk about giving away the store. I don't even know if I could blame this on Russo. Did Russo leave by this point? Because this was right around the time that Russo bailed. And he went to WCW. So I'm actually not sure if this SmackDown show would have fallen. It probably would have. I'm guessing this was one of the last shows he probably wrote. It sounds like a Russo show. 20 years ago, on September 25th, 2000, WCW Monday Nitro aired live from Long Island's Nassau Coliseum, the now, at least temporarily, shuttered Nassau Coliseum here on out on Long Island. Long Island's own Vince Russo, the hometown boy with no hometown fans, booked himself to win the WCW world title in a cage match against Booker T, ending with Goldberg spearing Russo through the cage door, giving him a legitimate concussion. This was booked 5 months to the day. 5 months after WCW put the world championship on David Arquette. I'm trying to decide which was worse, putting their world title on David Arquette or putting their world title on Vince Russo. Actually, I take that back. Putting the title on David Arquette or Vince Russo putting the world title on himself. I'm going to go with Russo. He vacated the title a week later. It's worth noting, by the way, that David Arquette did not want to become the WCW champion, but he was talked into it. David Arquette, a man who at least has some common sense. I cannot say the same about the other person. 18 years ago, on September 21st, 2002, Xavier, who just passed away last month, beat Low Key to become only the second Ring of Honor champion in the company's short history. 9 years ago, on September 26th, 2011, the lost Hell in a Cell match that you may not know about took place on this date. It only went about 5 minutes. It was a dark match after a live episode of Raw. WWE held a 5-man Hell in a Cell match that saw John Cena defeat CM Punk, Alberto Del Rio, Dolph Ziggler, and Jack Swagger to retain the WWE title. It is still to this day the shortest Hell in a Cell match in history. And 3 years ago, on September 24th, 2017, WWE held its No Mercy pay-per-view, and in their very first big one-on-one meeting, Roman Reigns defeated John Cena in something of a passing of the torch. I always love to use that expression. Brock Lesnar beat Braun Strowman with one single F5 to retain the Universal title in a very disappointing match. This is the match that really stalled in my opinion. Whatever momentum that Braun had at the time, there was a time where it made sense to put the title on the big guy, and this felt like it was it, and they didn't do it. And by the time they did this year, he lucked into the spot because Roman Reigns went home. By that point, it already felt like his chance had come and gone. But also that night, something else happened. On that night, Neville wrestled his final pay-per-view match for WWE. He lost the Cruiserweight Championship to Enzo Amore. No wonder he quit the company after this. I don't even need to say any more. Actually, according to Enzo, the two of them were best friends. That's what Enzo Amore says. He goes, the two of them were like, I'm crossing my fingers here. They were like this. They were tight. They were best friends. They rode together. He claimed that the plan that they had come up with was for Neville, after he dropped the belt to Enzo, to then leave 205 Live. Because what was left for Neville to do? I mean, Neville's talent. If you're the kind of person who isn't a fan of all the smaller guys in wrestling, there are some smaller guys who I think absolutely belong on the main roster and belong in the ring with guys who maybe are bigger than them because they just have that much talent. They have something to offer beyond just being confined to the Cruiserweight division. That was Neville. And I don't really think we didn't get to see a side of him until he came to AEW that I think even more than in WWE, he showed a side of him in AEW that proved that he absolutely belongs in the ring with some of the top stars in the company. This is not a guy that should be limited to 205 Live. This is not a guy that should be limited to, you know, AEW Dark or something like that. He's a talented guy. And he had done all he can do, and he was ready to move on. And so that was kind of their idea. You know, you're going to drop the belt to me, and that's going to be your swan song on 205 Live. And then he's going to go work Raw or go work SmackDown. But after he dropped the title to Enzo at No Mercy, Vince McMahon told Neville that he was going to keep him on 205 Live. 205 Live is a death sentence. That's not me being disrespectful to the people who wrestle on that show. There's a lot of talented guys, I'm sure, right now on the 205 Live roster. But if you want to break out and become a bigger star, it is a death sentence. That is not a show that I would want to be on. If I had aspirations to be more than just looked at as a cruiserweight, I would not want to be on 205 Live. And Vince McMahon decided that he was going to have him stay there and that he was going to have him continue to work, this time as a babyface, against a heel Enzo Amore. And at that point, Neville said, well, peace out. I'm going home. And he did. He flew home. Now, Enzo said the idea was that he would drop the title. Neville would. And the clause in the contract was that he does not get a rematch. And that would have paved the way for Neville to move on. So he no-showed Monday Night Raw the very next night. It just so happened the main event that night was to have been Neville against Enzo Amore, only there was no Neville because he didn't show up. And they had to rebook the main event a couple of hours before the show went on the air. Now, Neville, for his part, he did a Q&A on this subject. He did a Q&A on Instagram last year. No, I'm sorry, that wasn't last year. It was a year later. So I guess 2 years ago. And he had a slightly different take on the whole best friends with Enzo Amore thing. He said that Enzo was not the reason he left. He doesn't hate the guy. He just found him to be annoying backstage. And putting the title on him, in his words, was bad. He said, especially beating me. I was worth more than being jobbed out to jobbers. That is why I left. Now, if I were best friends with somebody and they talked about me the way that Neville talked about Enzo Amore there, I wouldn't be best friends with them anymore. But hey, that's me. But good on Pac getting the hell out of that company if they didn't have the fucking common sense to see that this is not a guy to be wasted on a dead brand like 205 Live, then he absolutely needed to get the hell out of there. And I'm happy he did. If you have questions for the mailbag, we're going to take a few right now before we wrap up. Please email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I want to hear from all of you. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Jeremy from Queens, New York. What are your thoughts on Jim Cornette giving Rock versus Hogan from WrestleMania 18, which he never saw before, 5 stars on his watch-along? Do you agree with his rating? Dave Meltzer only gave the match 3 stars. Why do Dave Meltzer's star ratings bother people so much? I'm not saying they bother Jeremy, but like, why do they seem to bother people a lot? I actually get a kick out of it. I find it amusing how irritated some people seem to be by it. It's his opinion of the match. I know he has a louder megaphone than most, but it's his opinion of the match. He has his tastes and his opinions just like anybody else does. His just happened to be a little more amplified. I mean, think of all the wrestling that this guy watches on a weekly basis from all over the world, right? His standards are going to be very different than somebody who only sits at home and watches nothing but WWE all day. But as far as Cornette goes, I agree. I'm going to agree with Jim Cornette. I think that Rock and Hogan at WrestleMania 18 was a 5-star match. It's one of my all-time favorite matches. That is the kind of match that got me to fall in love in the first place as a kid with pro wrestling. That match would not have worked with any other two guys in the ring on that night. In that building, in that city, Hogan was just, he was treated like a god in Toronto. There were a lot of people in the building that night who probably were in the building rooting for Hogan in 1990 when he had a match with the Ultimate Warrior. So you talk about nostalgia overload. The man was beloved, even though he tried to murder The Rock on television a week or two before by driving a truck into an ambulance, attempted vehicular homicide. They loved him. I don't think it was that they hated The Rock. They just loved Hogan. But it was his first WrestleMania match in, what was it, like 9 years? He was the biggest star in company history coming home. This was his big homecoming. There probably would be no WrestleMania were it not for all those early Hulk Hogan matches with Piper and with Andre and Savage. That's what made WrestleMania what it was. So the atmosphere was perfect. The way they worked, the match was perfect. The psychology was perfect. The Hulk up, it still gives me goosebumps every time I go back and watch it. And yeah, there were a couple of botched spots in the match. I think at one point Hogan tried to take a bump out over the top rope and he didn't quite make it. So there were a couple of moments like that. But I didn't say it was perfect. I just said that in my mind, it was a 5-star match because that match was the perfect WrestleMania match. Same with Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker in 2009. A very different match than Rock Hogan, but when a match gets you to feel a certain way, you're marking out like you're 9 years old all over again, man. I mean, that's what it's all about. I can't think of too many matches these days that would get me to do that. But when you can have moments like that, that's what it's all about. That is what it's all about. Even the commentary. I mean, although Jim Ross, he tried his hardest. Jim Ross tried his hardest to convince the people that, oh, it's a mixed reaction, King. It's a mixed reaction. He was full of shit. That was no mixed reaction. That match, it also gave us the greatest Jim Ross call ever. When Hogan dropped the leg after the big Hulk up. And everybody was losing their minds. And Hogan dropped the big leg on The Rock. And Jim Ross screams, he beat Andre the Giant with that move. Oh my God. I mean, in the most climactic moment of the match, he managed to tie it in to another classic match. It was the perfect call. I know that his call after Mick Foley got thrown off the Hell in a Cell, that's probably the more iconic call. It's memed. Even non-wrestling fans have heard that commentary placed over other, like, sports moments and stuff. So, yes, that's the more popular call of his. My, you know, as God is my witness, he's broken in half. But that call in the Rock Hogan match is probably my favorite WWE call of his. And my only gripes, I have two gripes with that match. And one actually came after the match, technically. It still bothers me that The Rock won with the people's elbow. I know that the move was over, but Hulk Hogan losing to the people's elbow at WrestleMania, it's just wrong. It's just wrong. And now, at least he gave him two rock bottoms. Right before the people's elbow, he did give him two rock bottoms. So that sort of softened the blow, I guess. But my other gripe is that when Rock got Hogan to pose after the match, they didn't play Real American. They played no music at all. I guess they just wanted the music, the moment to breathe on its own. If you're going to go play off people's nostalgia, and you got Hulk Hogan back and he's posing in the ring at WrestleMania, you got to go all the way with it. Hogan posing to Real American, even though they were in Canada. Hogan posing to Real American after that. Well, I mean, Canada's North America, so it still fits. That would have been just the cherry on top. But those are my only gripes. And I'm kind of reaching with them, but those are my only gripes, really, with the match. 5 stars does not always mean technical masterpiece. You know, I could watch an Okada-Kenny Omega match from their series, and I think, what was it, the second one, I think. That was a 5-star match. I don't know how many Meltzer gave. He probably gave it 17 stars. I could look at a match like that and go, in my mind, that's a 5-star match. That's a 10 out of 10 match. And I could look at Rock and Hogan, who did nothing even remotely close to some of the things that Kenny Omega and Okada did in their match, and think that that's also a 5-star match. I could look at Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker at WrestleMania 25 and say to you that that's a 5-star match. I could look at Bret Hart and Steve Austin in their submission match at WrestleMania 13 and tell you, one of the most important matches in the history of the company, 5-star match. They're all different. They don't all follow the same formula. They don't all follow the same style of wrestling. So again, I sometimes will have this debate with people when they talk about the star rating system, which is why I really don't use a star rating system when I, you know, review stuff, or I try not to, because people just lose their minds over it. But 5 stars does not always mean technical masterpiece. And if you think it does, and that's all it means, then you just don't understand professional wrestling. Or I should say, you and I have two very different views of pro wrestling, if that's what you think. And I think your view happens to be a warped view. But I don't think people truly appreciate the epic run of matches that The Rock had at WrestleMania in the early 2000s. He had what some people will call the greatest WrestleMania main event of all time. The year before, Rock and Hogan. That was the match with Austin at the Astrodome, WrestleMania 17. So he goes from that match at the Astrodome. 1 year later, he has this match at the Sky Dome with Hogan, to one last match with Steve Austin at Safeco Field in front of 54,000 people. He beat Hogan and Austin in back-to-back years. The only man in history to ever beat Hulk Hogan and Stone Cold Steve Austin at WrestleMania. And John Cena, many years later. The only guy to do that is The Rock. It's Tori's birthday on Tuesday, and he's got two questions. With Ric Flair's charisma and promo skills, why do you think he never made any movies? I thought he did. Well, I thought Flair was in one movie. I don't remember what movie it was. But yeah, he was never like a feature film star the way Hogan got some movies and Piper had some movies. Or even Jesse Ventura. I don't know. I mean, I assume it's because he just didn't have that action star look like Hogan did. So those roles really wouldn't have been available to him. But then again, I mean, Roddy Piper didn't really look like a big bodybuilder type. Terry Funk didn't have that look either, and they got movie roles. Honestly, it may have just had more to do with the fact that he was the man. He was riding that lightning bolt at that time, was Ric Flair. And he didn't have time to go off and do movies when he was at his peak of popularity. That would be my guess. His second question. I read a Forbes magazine interview with Vince McMahon a few years ago stating that he might not pass the company on to Triple H. because he did not want Paul to make the same sacrifices that he did. If he follows that path, who do you see Vince selling the company to? I think he's waiting to sell to a big company that can afford to pay big bucks. Disney gets floated around a lot. You know what, though? I could see that at some point. I think WWE could be very useful to Disney. I don't know that Disney would just buy WWE, though, and just run it independently the way that it's run right now. I don't know what their vision for WWE would be. It could be a very different company. But I think that's probably what he's waiting to do. He's probably, you know, he's going to drop before anything happens. Vince McMahon, the likelihood, I think, of him retiring or selling, he's probably just going to go until he just drops. And then at that point, well, I guess we'll see what happens. But if he were to make a move, that would seem to be the move to me. You sell to a big company like Disney, $2, $3 billion, $4 billion, if you can get the price back up around there. That's probably what he's waiting on. Now, Adrian on Twitter reminded me, I did not realize this, he reminded me that this week marks the 10-year anniversary of Sound Off episode 127, where I pitched my own WWE business review, my business plan for WWE. If, hypothetically, Vince McMahon walked out of Titan Tower one day, and I believe the way I phrased it was, Vince McMahon walks out of Titan Tower, and Matt Hardy, who was having some issues at the time, in a drunken rage, drives up from North Carolina through Stamford, and he runs down Vince McMahon in cold blood. And in his will, Vince McMahon leaves WWE not to his wife, not to his kids, but to me. Now, why he would do this is not relevant. But now I have the power, so what moves would I make? Understanding, of course, that some of these ideas were not totally 100% realistic, but I thought many of them were. Many of them could easily have been done. I wanted to take a few minutes here real quick before we end and just review what I pitched 10 years ago. This was 2 years before Raw moved to 3 hours every single week. The show is down 56%, by the way, from where they were ratings-wise in 2012, shortly after moving to 3 hours. 56% reduction in audience. Even if you account for changes in TV and streaming and all that, 56%, that is no small drop. But I went back and I was reviewing, and so again, just real quick, one of the things I did was I was looking at all of the rosters, all the major rosters at the time, the TNA roster, the Ring of Honor roster, various indie workers who may have been available. Who would I bring in? Who would I want to bring to WWE to be on my roster? Well, I looked at the time at the TNA roster, assuming that, let's say, TNA was on death's door, and these talents were available and they were just ripe for the picking. Who would I bring in? I had Kurt Angle on my list because I always wanted Kurt Angle back. Kurt Angle deserved to finish his career at WWE. Jeff Hardy. And Jeff Hardy was actually having some issues himself, not just his brother, at that time. But Jeff Hardy was still a big name. The Pope. I thought the Pope was going to be a bigger star than he turned out to be. Abyss. Always wanted Abyss. I know some people would look at Abyss early on. Oh, he's a knockoff Mankind. Yeah, with the mask, maybe he was. And the hardcore stuff, I could see where people would kind of think that. But I thought there was definitely a spot for Abyss to get over the way that Foley did in the Mankind character on the WWE roster and feud with The Undertaker and Kane and people like that. I had people like Samoa Joe on my list, AJ Styles, Desmond Wolfe, Magnus, Jay Lethal, Amazing Red, Doug Williams, Jeremy Borash, Don West, and Taz. On the tag team side, Motor City Machine Guns, Beer Money, Generation Me, and the Beautiful People. I thought all could have been brought in and utilized in my WWE. I would have absolutely pushed for a program between The Undertaker and Sting at WrestleMania. And then, my plan for Sting was to bring him in for a WrestleMania program with The Undertaker, but also give him the DVD treatment and put him in the Hall of Fame. So I had my plan for Sting all ready to go back in 2010. And I thought Ric Flair could be used as a manager or maybe an authority figure to replace the existing authority figure at that time. So as far as the TNA roster, that was my plan for all those people. Ring of Honor. Tyler Black, at the time, had just signed with WWE. I would have brought him in anyway, but he had just been signed. The future Seth Rollins. I would have brought in Colt Cabana, and I would have immediately linked him up with CM Punk. I thought Colt Cabana got a raw deal, his first run in WWE, the Scotty Goldman run. He deserved another chance. I thought there was a lot of potential in doing stuff on camera with him and Punk, given their relationship at the time. Daisy Hayes. Daisy Hayes was a female talent in Ring of Honor who I had seen at many of the live events I had been at. I was impressed by her. I would have brought her in. And Sara Del Rey, who eventually, she did get hired, but not on TV. She got hired as a trainer down in developmental. I would have brought in, on the tag team side, just two teams. The Briscoes and the Kings of Wrestling. It's a shame that Claudio and Chris Hero never had a chance to do the tag team thing in WWE. On the independent side, there were a lot of people who were independent at that time and not signed to either company who I would have looked into bringing in. Haas and Benjamin. Shelton Benjamin and Charlie Haas were unsigned at that time. Takeshi Morishima from NOAH. Morishima was a big name at that time. Chuck Taylor, who of course now is with Trent, doing the Best Friends Act in AEW. Ricochet was on my list. Boy, do I regret that. Mickie James was also not signed to any particular company at that time. And Awesome Kong. So on the indie side, those are the names I would have looked at. The NXT Season 2 rookies, Caval, Alex Riley, Michael McGillicuddy, I would have sent him to FCW, and Husky Harris. Those are the names I was interested in. The Divas from NXT Season 3. I thought Lance Storm at that time had a great quote. He said, "My biggest complaint with the Divas NXT season is the experience level of the girls. I don't think most of these girls are ready for TV. Instead of being a pro on the show, I'd rather have WWE send some of these girls to the Storm Wrestling Academy for me to work with them for a few months to better prepare them for NXT." And I agreed with that wholeheartedly. Storm was looked at as very highly regarded as a trainer. And there were a lot of people that trained under him who eventually did sign with WWE, and a lot of women. And I think that would have been a very smart thing to do, and I would have done it. If I were in charge, I would have absolutely worked with Lance Storm. I would have done that. Who would I have sent down to developmental? Who would I have sent back to FCW? Michael Tarver, Darren Young, Lucky Cannon, Percy Watson, my God with these fucking names, and Lacey Von Erich. Lacey Von Erich, I don't even think is involved in the wrestling business anymore, but those are the people who would have needed more time or would have needed to first pass through developmental. Now, as far as the developmental is concerned, I would have hired a team of WWE scouts to visit independent events throughout the world. If they were doing any of this at that time, I don't think they were doing too much of it. I think now they do that. William Regal pops up at a lot of independent shows. But I would have hired a dedicated team of scouts, ex-wrestlers, whoever, to go all throughout the world, not just the U.S. Travel the world, observe talent, submit evaluations to management. I would have continued to do what they were already doing, which is having Gerald Briscoe and Jim Ross make scouting trips themselves and submit reports. But what I had pitched was having a dedicated team go all over the world and do that. Now, at the time, this is 2010. There was a report in the Observer at the time that said the key is that WWE is not looking for accomplished workers. They would, in many cases, rather have tall guys with good bodies and good faces who are young, who have never worked before so they can train them from scratch in their own style. I disagreed and still disagree. And thankfully, WWE has changed since then, but I disagreed wholeheartedly with that philosophy. I always thought that it's better to feature multiple styles instead of just one style, just the WWE style. No one wants to see that. It's nice to have a little bit of variety in the different styles. One of the things that made WCW stand out when they were hot as they ever were, with the cruiserweights mixed in with the main event level heavyweights, you had a nice mix. Also, you know, I made this point at that time. If you're just looking for pretty faces, big jacked up bodies, just think of all the guys, all the people who never would have been given a second look, who were huge stars and legends in the wrestling business. You get a guy like a Dusty Rhodes or an Arn Anderson who comes walking by the performance. I don't even think there was a performance center back then. It was FCW. Performance center didn't exist. But based on these standards that WWE had set in 2010, imagine if Arn Anderson had walked into the building at FCW. They would have taken one look at him and said, no, we don't need an accountant. We have somebody. They would have thought that he was there for something completely different. It's like, yeah, we don't need that. We don't need the help. It's like, no, I'm here to be a wrestler. Oh, really? Well, not for us. They'd take one look at this guy and they'd send him packing. Jake Roberts, Ric Flair, Dusty Rhodes, Shawn Michaels, for God's sakes. He would have been too small. This is how they were back in 2010. That's it was 10 years, but it's not that long ago. And the change in philosophy, and I know there's a lot of people who are going to look at that as being a negative because they don't like all the small guys. Oh, that's what killed WWE. They became indie-rific and they welcomed in all the independent guys who were 5'8". It's just a difference in philosophy. There's some fans who like that. There's some fans who don't. But that's a huge change in philosophy from where we were in 2010 to where we are today. I would have set up additional farm systems beyond just OVW. My idea at that time was to set up a good 3 or 4 different territories, territory-like systems, where talent could rotate. Guys can work in one territory and then be sent to another one to work under different trainers and learn different styles, and they can make a name for themselves on the local scene, working local shows in, let's say, the Florida market, and then they get shipped off somewhere to the Midwest and they get to work there. And maybe they get shipped off to California. Now they're out in the West Coast and they're learning from different people there and they're working spot shows there. So that was one, and I think the Storm Wrestling Academy up in Canada, that could have been one of those territories. Because he wasn't just training people, but for a while there, Lance Storm was actually running shows as well. So I love the idea of having this rotating territory-like system where people can go and train and learn. The creative team. I would have surrounded myself with people who actually were knowledgeable about wrestling booking. And some of the names I floated at that time, and it is kind of funny now to look back on this, but Paul Heyman was on my list, Dutch Mantel was on my list, and Jim Cornette was on my list. I suspect that probably would not have ended well with Cornette, but there's no denying that he definitely would have had something to contribute. I feel like all of these guys have something that they can contribute. They have things they're good at, they have things they're not so good at. So you bring guys like that on board to try to help you out, and I think that they put you on the right path. But I used to talk about how, boy, it just felt like WWE television used to be so much better when it was literally just two guys writing the show. It was Vince McMahon. He was the filter, but they'd meet at Vince's house by the pool. You've heard these stories of Vince McMahon having poolside meetings at his home. Bruce Pritchard is there, and Pat Patterson is there. It's the three of them. And they're booking shows out for months. Now they have a lot more television to produce. Live television. Than they did back then. The roster is so much bigger now. So I don't know that 2 or 3 people could do it. But do you really need an army of 30 people? Look at the product. doesn't seem to be doing a lot of good when everything is ultimately just coming down to one guy. The system back then was so much more simple. Pay-per-views. I am not a fan. I'm still not a fan, to be honest with you. But, you know, back then, they were having pay-per-view. They were having 13 pay-per-views a year. 13, 14 pay-per-views. Sometimes two in 1 month. I would have reduced that back down to the Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, King of the Ring, SummerSlam, Survivor Series. And then in between, you can set up these other special shows, whether it's a Clash of the Champions type show, to kind of bridge the gap from one pay-per-view to the other by having these other special shows in between. Whether those were pay-per-views or just, you know, TV specials, it probably would have been just a TV special. Wrestlers probably would not have been thrilled about losing those extra pay-per-view payoffs, but that's one of those things I would have, as the chairman and CEO, that's one of those things I would have had to work through. But I talked about War Games becoming an annual Survivor Series tradition. What else did I talk about here? I talked about a whole bunch of things. Talked about bringing in Jim Ross for special events only to call certain shows and certain matches with Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler. And that's really what WWE ended up doing. They would bring Jim Ross in for a special WrestleMania match each year. That's the role I would have envisioned for him going forward. Television, I would have completely revamped the whole NXT concept. The NXT concept back then was a joke. I would have had a season of 10 guys paired off on teams of five. Each team led by a WWE pro. I basically would have followed the Ultimate Fighter format, but I would have applied it to NXT. And the season, the NXT season, would have built to a program between the two pros. Like with the Ultimate Fighter, it built to a fight between the two coaches. So that postseason would have led to a pay-per-view match. But each episode, under my idea, would have focused on a different rookie, or would have focused on drama between them and show them training at the gym or at FCW shows. You have a match at the end of each show. Judges would determine who stays and who gets cut based on their performance, based on their promos. So that was my idea for that. TNA Reaction was one of the, I think, Eric Bischoff ideas during his run there on TNA that I actually liked. I remember that TNA Reaction show. I thought it was very well done. I think WWE should have had a similar type of show. I would have killed the guest star concept. I think by that point we had already gotten Bob Barker. There was no beating Bob Barker. I would have killed the guest host concept dead a lot earlier than they did. I pitched the idea of having backstage pay-per-view reports with Josh Matthews or Jeremy Borash or Don West, similar to what they used to do many years ago with Gene Okerlund and Todd Pettengill, where instead of just having the announcers sitting at ringside and just doing kind of a voiceover, well, here are the matches coming up at the next pay-per-view, you cut away and have an actual pay-per-view report. And bring people up to speed on, okay, the latest announcements. Here's the latest match added to the next show. But they feel they can't do stuff like that now. You got to keep things moving. It's TV. People are going to lose interest. They're going to turn off. I don't know that I necessarily think doing a segment like that is going to turn away 200,000 people, but I assume there's a reason why they don't do that. And then just some final miscellaneous ideas. I would have ended the brand split. I'm sure that's shocking, right? 10 years later to hear me talking about this back then. But what I would have done is I would have kept the rosters still somewhat separate. I just wouldn't have had the handcuffs in place where you absolutely can't do this and you absolutely can't do that. I was arguing for a top 10 power rankings for the WWE Championship, top 5 for all other belts. I pitched bringing back managers. This was during a period where WWE, it was like they were allergic to managers. You had Jim Mitchell was available, Joel Gertner, even Byron Saxton I floated. Larry Sweeney. What a sin that Larry Sweeney never had a run as a manager in WWE. The other idea that I forgot about this, that I pitched, maybe this is the Vince McMahon-esque side of me coming out here. But if I were running the company, and I see all of these, like, WrestleMania weekend and stuff. You have all these wrestling conventions, and they're piggybacking off my events and everything, right? I always thought to myself, if I'm WWE, why wouldn't I just host my own Legends conventions? And I invite all these legends in, and I can probably pay them a little bit more than they're going to make working, you know, a convention somewhere else. And just host my own Legends conventions with all these same people and put all these other conventions out of business. That's what I would have done. I said, well, anything, if you guys can do it, then I can do it shortly. And that way we put all these other guys out of business. That's what I would have done. But yeah, some other ideas that I really, I don't know if they did it and we just don't know, or if they just never thought to do it. They put together some incredible DVD documentaries. And I think it's a real mistake if they didn't submit them to film festivals. That was one of the ideas that I had back then, is to submit some of their DVD documentaries to film festivals for awards consideration. I would have hired Don West and brought him in to run wild with WWE Shop. Like a bulldog. Just let him loose. You would have sold so much merch with this guy. And the other thing I would have done is I would have lifted the ban that they had in place, which they're, I don't know if it's a complete lift now, but there's definitely more access now than there was 10 years ago. They had an outright ban for many years on giving interviews, letting their talent do interviews with wrestling news websites, even like the really reputable ones, like a PW Insider or a OneWrestling.com or The Observer or The Torch. It was just a total ban. Not fan-friendly at all. And I would have lifted that ban. And, you know, made some of the stars a little more accessible for certain interviews when it came to some of those websites. So anyway, that was the kind of the quick overview. I dedicated a lot more time, over 90 minutes to this, more in-depth. If you want to hear the full review, it's up in the archives, episode 127 from, I guess it was September. It might have been September 25th of 2010. Always interesting to go back and take a look at stuff like that. Keep emailing me your questions, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I'm going to be with you again live tonight on YouTube as soon as Clash of Champions goes off the air. I'll be hosting the Wrestle Rumble giveaway, so head on over to WrestleRumble.com. $1 will buy you one entry into the contest. You can walk away with 8 NXT replica belts. And that's it. I got a watch list of TV. I'm not going to have time today, but I've been trying to get through. I have my own little watch list of all the TV shows and movies that I have either fallen behind on or that people have recommended to me. I've had a lot of people recommend the show The Boys. I haven't started that yet. I mean, there are shows that I watch that I haven't even gotten to the new seasons of, like Money Heist and stuff on Netflix. There's so much good shit. But one of the things I've been trying to do is get through a lot of these movies that I have never seen, and I'm kind of ashamed that I've never seen some of these movies. I'm actually four movies deep so far into my watch list. And I feel ashamed as a big of a John Carpenter fan as I am, that I never saw In the Mouth of Madness. Now I have. I thought it was good. I saw The Fog for the first time the other day, which I enjoyed a little bit more. I finally watched New Jack City, which I'm sure a lot of people will be happy to hear. They couldn't believe I had never seen New Jack City. I just watched New Jack City. First time I've seen Mario Van Peebles in a movie in probably 20 years. I thought it was good. I enjoyed it. And last night, for the first time, as somebody who I mean, I'm a product of the 80s, and I love horror movies, and I've seen Fright Night, and I've seen a lot of these vampire movies. I've never seen The Lost Boys. Don't know how that happened. So I finally watched The Lost Boys for the first time last night. I enjoyed the hell out of it. I thought it was very good. So next on my list is Joker. I never did see Joker with Joaquin Phoenix. So I'm going to try to get that done in the next few days. And onward to all the other movies. Got a whole bunch of them on my list. And I wanted to also say thank you to the people who took advantage last week on the ExpressVPN link that I promoted here on the podcast. First of all, I want to thank everybody for supporting any and all of our sponsors, especially this one, though, because I got them back on board, you know, post-pandemic now. Things were kind of quiet most of the year, but got them back on board, and I really want to make sure that they appreciate the loyalty and the full force of the Sound Off family. And I do use the service. And so if you're going to, if thinking about using a VPN, I hope you'll use that link and sign up. You get an extra 3 months free on a 1 year plan when you use that link, and you are supporting the show in ways that you can only imagine. So expressvpn.com/Solomonster is the link to use. You'll hear me mentioning them a few more times between now and the end of the year. But for the people who did use it, or at least plugged in that link and went and read up on it and checked it out to see if it's something that might be useful to you, I appreciate it. Please use that link. Spread it to anybody else who you think might be able to use it. I will see you guys live tonight on YouTube immediately after the pay-per-view and back here again for episode 672 next Sunday. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and I will see you live again tonight on the stream. Take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Are you the person that's talking on WWE?
Well, I am talking about WWE right now. Is that your sister in the background?
Yeah.
Tell her not to watch The Fiend wrestle John Cena, because The Fiend is going to murder John Cena. I'm gonna.
What?
I gotta let you go. Sorry. What can I say? I gotta warn the kids. The kids need to be aware of what's going on. Now, if I didn't warn that child just now, he would watch WrestleMania, he would watch John Cena be torn to shreds, he would be scarred for life. I just did that kid a favor. Don't look at me. Oh my goodness. I'm going to hell.
The Solomonster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster sounds off.